This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually illusion is usually, but in the battle for civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that I expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Well, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually illusion is usually, but in the battle for civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that I expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Well, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Mr. John Quirk. And Mr. Quirk, of course, teaches at a diplomatic school in Paris. And, of course, he lives alternately between Florida and he has a farm in Normandy. He's written a number of books and articles on the intelligence community, the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA entrance examination, the FBI entrance examination, CIA and drug wars, a 1986 book, Drug Enforcement Agents, Latin America and the News, United Nations, our U.S. National Security Concerns for the Year, New Targets and Goals for National Security, All European Intelligence Services, Foreign Local Police, Cooperation, Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, Banking Secret Havens, and Terror in Latin America. Mr. Quirk is a world traveler. He's in touch with people all throughout the world and in the school for diplomats and retired diplomats. Of course, they teach people about diplomatic protocol and so much more. Mr. Quirk, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thanks, Stan. It's my pleasure.
Well, let's talk a little bit about certainly what you do. Why do diplomats need to go to school?
Well, they need to go to school, and people that are studying diplomacy need to look at other areas of just typical diplomatic studies. In the world we live in today, that diplomats have to know about international trade and finance, national security, terrorism, foreign policy, and international relations, not just the art of diplomacy, which is negotiation.
All right, fine. Well, now, of course, you're living in Europe. You probably have somewhat of a different perspective of what's going on in Europe, in the Middle East, and here in the United States. I have a feeling we're entering into a very difficult and dangerous time. What are your thoughts?
Well, we are in an extremely dangerous time. If you look back at President Bush's speech on Axis of Evil, which identified Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. Iraq, of course, is off the chessboard, but we actually have more enemies and adversaries. We have to also question some of the reactions of our friends. We have threats from Venezuela. The North Korean bilateral and multilateral talks to end their nuclear program has not made any progress at all. You have the rise of intelligence services in Russia. And, of course, this year, the State Department, the intelligence community, and our policymakers for the first time overtly identified China as our main future adversary.
And of course, how can America alone do all of this? Certainly, you know, we have the greatest military in the world, but we've got some real financial problems, and many people feel that we are spending far beyond our means, and there may well soon be a financial crisis. Are you hearing any rumbles about that in Europe?
No, you know, I'll tell you where we are. I feel that we're such a rich country, such a strong country, and we're getting richer and stronger. The Europeans are going the other way. They just are...
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back in just a moment with Mr. John Quirk. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Mr. John Quirk. And Mr. Quirk, I had the opportunity to meet recently. He teaches at a school for diplomats in Paris. He lives in Normandy and in Florida. He's a world traveler. He's written extensively on intelligence and certainly on the intelligence agencies and the FBI entrance examination. He's written probably 20 or 30 articles and books, certainly well qualified to discuss what's happening in the diplomatic and intelligence fields, and I had just simply asked him if he was concerned about what was happening to the United States from a financial point of view with our massive deficits, both trade and domestic, and he said no, that America is such a strong country, and that certainly in Europe the economies there are going the wrong way. So would you like to pick up on that idea?
Yeah, one of the problems that the Europeans have is that they're so socialist that the tax structure is just draining them. And one of the things that they don't understand is that you've got to spend more money in research and development. So you develop a new microchip, you fund a new university. Some of that money is wasted, but in the end, research and development is what fuels the economy of America. In Europe, they have a hard time putting money into research and development because they can't afford to waste any money. And as a result, you have great medical care in Europe, you have great bridges, roads, infrastructure, they have very weak militaries, and the tax structure is unbelievably. Europe, however, is starting gradually to come around to the American point of view. Right after 9/11, Europe was very anti-American. The populations are still anti-American. But even France, Spain, and other countries, especially with the incident of the Danish cartoons, are starting to realize that radical Islamic fundamentalism is a threat to Western civilization. And in the last few weeks, France, Scandinavia, and some of the more liberal countries in Europe are starting to come around to the United States' point of view regarding national security issues.
Well, now, do you foresee a war between the West and radical Islam? Do you foresee a war with Iran sometime in the next year or two?
I think that when you're talking about radical Islam, I think there'll be constant low-intensity conflicts, especially with countries that may be threatened by radical fundamentalism. When it comes to Iran, yes, I see that they do not want to negotiate. They have threatened Israel. They've denied the Holocaust. There is a radical sect there that is influencing the mullahs to...
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this afternoon is Mr. John Quirk. And I had simply asked the question, will there be a war with Iran? And John had replied, yes, there seems to be a very, very radical element that controls the reins of government in Iran. They've certainly denied the Holocaust. They seem to be violently anti-Israel. And Mr. Quirk, I think, really feels that it's a matter not if, but when the war comes with Iran. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes, I think it'll be a limited war. I don't think we'll put troops in or invade, or we won't destroy their culture. We don't want to destroy their cities. It'll be a very brief attack on their 450 nuclear facilities. We have the ability to do that almost technologically with new cruise and Tomahawk missiles. The Israelis probably don't have that ability. And as the Iranians get closer to the development of a nuclear weapon, if they don't have it already, I think that the Bush administration will actually receive pressure from Europe, other countries, And I think the Democrats and Republicans will close ranks, and instead of Bush initiating it, they will demand that the president take action against Iran.
Well, but won't this inflame the entire Islamic world against the United States?
Well, it could, but you see, the Iranians are not Arabs. They're Persians. And even though they're Muslims, their brand of Islam, which is mainly Shia, doesn't go very well in all of the other 25 Muslim countries. So if it's over quickly, I don't think we'll give a chance for radical Islam to do anything. The other thing is the Iranians are the ones that are fueling a lot of radical Islamic movements. They fund Hamas, they fund Islamic Jihad, they fund Hezbollah, and their intelligence service is the one that's stirring up a lot of trouble over these Danish cartoons.
I'm sure that they are. On the other hand, doesn't Saudi Arabia actually fund Hamas as well, and certainly much of the anti-Israeli movement within the Palestinians?
I think so, but the thing about the Saudis, they've paid extortion to everybody over the years, including Al-Qaeda and the Madras schools and the Wahhabi sect, and they don't exclusively fund Hamas. They are actually, the Saudis have with their relationship with the Bush family, have actually reached out to the United States and said, if there ever is a war with Iran and oil is interrupted, we will make up the difference. So they're trying to ingratiate themselves back with the United States.
Well, I would think that, especially after 15 of the 19 hijackers just happened to come from Saudi Arabia,
that's correct.
I would think that they would be very, very loath to do anything to antagonize the American people. They might begin looking at who the fellow is behind the mask there.
Right.
Anyway, under any circumstances, when do you think that the war might come, if it does come, with Iran? And, of course, this would have a profound impact, certainly on our currency. Or do you think it would have an impact on the value of our currency throughout the world?
No, I don't think it will have an impact if it's a one-week attack or less. And that's all you probably need to take out these 450 nuclear sites that are spread out through the country. It's most likely going to take place somewhere after the November elections, and maybe towards the end of the Bush administration. The congressional elections this November are very important to the Republican Party. They have some trouble over the port issue. They're hooking the whole policy for all Republican congressmen on national security. So Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, and the rise of China are all national security issues that have to be addressed. But Iran is probably on the top of the list.
Well, I think there are an awful lot of people in America who are quite incensed that the Bush administration doesn't see anything wrong with turning control of our ports over to a country that's controlled by the government of Dubai.
Well, you know, there's another story to that. Let me explain it, because I do not agree with a lot of the congressional opposition to the Dubai ports. Going back to the old saying, keep your friends close, keep your enemies closer. After 9/11, the Bush administration put billions of dollars in the maritime security. The Coast Guard is in 54 countries. We have ISI codes. We do background checks on all the crews of ships all over the world. We inspect containers. We put beepers in them. We've got two or three intelligence agencies that monitor the ports and inspect things that come into the port. And I think it's better to have a relationship with the UAE for intelligence than to push them away. Now, I know people are excited and they said, how could we turn this over to an Arab government? But the UAE, in their port security, has formed many agreements with the American intelligence community so we can detect a weapons of mass destruction that comes in a container. By blocking them and pushing them out, it actually gives a better reason for deployment by a radical group. And I think you'll start to see this as the debate goes on. I mean, Bush did not just do this in an isolated incident, and it's caused a furor. He's losing political capital on it. But I think when members of Congress start to understand the parameters of a small terrorist group trying to deploy a nuclear weapon in a container, they'll understand why the UAE is involved. They're not an enemy. Okay, They're a cooperating country because so much stuff is shipped through the UAE. So that's just my opinion on it.
All right. Well, it's going to be certainly. It is quite an issue, and I think many people are really begin to wonder how dedicated the Bush administration really is to the war on terror. When of course we see them consistently covering for Saudi Arabia and their involvement in the 9/11 attack, and as having censored the various government reports, both the initial Joint Intelligence Committee report and the 9/11 Commission report. And if they're not concealing anything, we have to ask why they wanted to censor this. Are they afraid that Osama bin Laden's going to find out what's going on?
Well, you know, we blame the Saudis, who are, it's a bizarre kind of venal country. But at the same time, you have to blame parts of our intelligence community, because for years we funded and managed the Saudi and Pakistani intelligence services.
You mean the RCIA was working very closely with both Saudi and Pakistani intelligence?
Of course. In terms of the Pakistani intelligence, we dropped the ball there because the head of the Pakistani intelligence service, ISI, we found out was actually helping bin Laden in obtaining weapons of mass destruction. We lost contact with the Pakistanis. Same thing with the Saudis. The Saudis were trained at CIA. Their police officers were trained at the FBI Academy in Quantico. We had great relations. Just before 9/11, they went mute. They didn't tell us what was happening. Their officers probably knew what bin Laden was up to. So there's plenty of blame to go around, not just blaming the Saudis or the Pakistanis. You also have to blame the United States, our intelligence services, that they should have had sources and penetrated both the Saudis and Pakistanis who had liaison relationships with Al-Qaeda.
What you're suggesting then is both the Saudis and the Pakistanis were working with Al-Qaeda?
Oh, yes. Well, I wouldn't say working with it. I would say that they knew they had enough intelligence on what bin Laden was going to do. And I believe the Iraqis also knew what bin Laden was going to do.
All right, fine. Then, what do you think is going to happen as far as Iraq is concerned? Certainly, we've been fighting with, the attack on September 11th over 4 years ago. I mean, the Second World War lasted only a little over 4 years. So, how long is this war going to drag on?
Well, I'm an optimist. You know, people are saying there's going to be a civil war in Iraq between the Sunni and the Shiites and the Kurds. But there's a lot of positive things happening in Iraq. We've spent billions there. Democracy is gradually starting to take hold. Security is increasing on the borders. The Syrians have backed off quite a bit. Some of our other people that were shipping guns to the insurgents have backed off. The real problem in Iraq is between the Sunni and the Shia. If we can't get those two people to work together, there could be a civil war. But we are doing everything on all levels, military, technological levels, training of police, diplomacy, training their diplomats to make sure it works.
Well, I've never understood why it was that when we went into Iraq, and certainly there was an attack society at that time, certainly it was corrupt, it was headed by a corrupt man, but why we dissolved the Iraqi army, and why we dissolved the Iraqi police force and the Iraqi civil service, and laid the base for the chaos that ultimately developed. It would have seemed to be much better to have tried to use the existing social structure, and then gradually, if there were bad people in that, to have gotten rid of them, rather than just sort of disband everything.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I think you put your finger on it. We should not have disbanded the Iraqi army. We disbanded it because it was full of Sunnis. And I've worked with Sunnis, Iraqis, when I was in France. I went overseas 2 days after 9/11, and I worked on Iraqi projects. And the Sunnis are very well educated. They wanted to be rehabilitated, but we at that time just could not trust them. So we decided, don't let any of them come in the army. Don't let any of them stay in the army. It's better to disband the whole army because the Ba'ath Party and the Sunnis ran the whole thing. So it's kind of hindsight looking at it, but I think Paul Bremer refers in his book that it was probably a mistake. So I don't know. We are rebuilding the army, and it's going pretty well. And, you know, it's one of these things that we did make a mistake. But as I said, a lot of progress is being made in Iraq. You just hear about the negative things, the bombings.
I was just reading an article in the New York Times about a general who was assigned the job of rebuilding the Iraqi army. An army for a nation of 25 million people. And he said he initially was given 6 people.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they gave him a few more. He was supposed to have 250 to build this massive army, but, well, occasionally they'd have 150 people. They wouldn't be there very long. And he said the Pentagon had this at the bottom of the list of their priorities. It seems that they really weren't that interested. That was the bottom of the priorities. I would have thought that would have been at the top of the priorities that we could begin pulling our troops out whole. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mr. John Quist, Mr. John Quirk, who, of course, teaches in a school for diplomats over in Paris. And I was just commenting that it was my concern. I would have thought the major priority for the Pentagon would have been to rebuild that Iraqi army that we mistakenly disbanded. And yet that seemed to be at the bottom of the priorities, at least according to the American general who was assigned the task of rebuilding the Iraqi army.
Well, don't forget the Shia were persecuted for over 35 years by Saddam Hussein. And they were excluded from most key positions in the army, the diplomatic corps, the business community. So to create an army of Shia who were not in senior positions was a Herculean task. The idea was you couldn't leave members of the Ba'ath Party there because then they'd have access to the weapons. Now, there's a building process going on, but what is happening, most of the insurgents are Sunnis and foreigners, and they want to destroy democracy in America. The Shias are in a key position. They've got to learn everything all over, how to be diplomats, how to be businessmen, how to be military officers. So it's going to be an uphill battle, but I think the United States will succeed in it.
Well, we hear about these death squads over there, where the Shia now, police officers are going out and just indiscriminately killing Sunnis, 20, 30, 50 here, there, and elsewhere. They find the graves of these people we put in power. Is this really true? Is this sort of thing going on?
Yes, it is true. It almost reminds me of what the right-wing death squads were doing in Colombia, killing, you know, drug dealers and killing Marxists. And the Shia, the insurgency in Iraq is now taking on a different kind of life. Instead of attacking Americans, they're trying to attack the Shia to cause a civil war, to cause trouble. So the Shia, they're getting fed up with their mosques being blown up and their businesses being blown up, and they're forming their own paramilitary groups. It's not as exaggerated as people think it is, but it's happening. It could increase if we don't get the Sunni insurgents and the foreigners out of the country. It could increase and it could lead to a civil war. But I think the United States is doing everything it can to head that off.
Well, of course, aren't the Shias, the Shia Muslims in the southern part of Iraq, forming a common alliance now with the Shias in Iran?
Yes, well, when you say forming a common alliance, the Iranians would love to influence them and eventually take over Iraq because the Shia relationship is very, very important. But a lot of that Iranian insurgency has been exaggerated, okay? They have shipped guns, they have stirred up trouble, but the Shia that we are working with in Iraq so far are very loyal to America. What will happen in 10 or 15 years, nobody knows. There may not be a Shia fundamentalist government in Iran, so we don't have to worry about it. So we're in a race. The Iranian Shia like the fact that there was democratic elections because the Shia, backed by the United States in Iraq, have won. They're hoping that if they can stay in power in Iran, they'll have an ally with the Shia. But that's a long way off. It could be anywhere from 7 to 15 years off. And by then, I think fundamentalist Iran will be removed from the chessboard.
All right. Well, it's going to be interesting to see what happens, especially after we attack Iran. I'm assuming we will. And I would think that at that point, they would probably be doing everything they could to stir up problems in American-occupied southern Iraq. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mr. John Gwirkin. He's certainly an expert on what's going on over in Iraq and certainly in Europe and throughout the world, because he lives in Paris and Normandy, and though he does have a home certainly in Florida. And I was simply commenting that if we do attack Iran, and I think Mr. Quirk feels that way, and I certainly feel, everything I hear from experts around the country ensures us that there's going to be a war with Iran. Of course, everybody thinks it's going to be a very short little war. That's how the First World War got started. It was just going to be a short little war. That's how the Boer War got started. They said everybody would be home by Christmas, but didn't quite work out that way. 100,000 British casualties later, why the troops did come home. But be that as it may, wouldn't the Shias in Iran do everything they could then to try to destabilize southern Iraq and try to destabilize Iraq to retaliate against us?
Well, I think their retaliation plans are probably more sophisticated. They know that they probably are going to receive an attack from the United States or Israel. And what they've done is they've formed terrorist cells in Venezuela, probably Canada and the United States. They have large intelligence operations in France. And I think that, and certainly they're not Iraqis, okay? We did not suffer any Iraqi terrorism in the United States before, during, or after the war with Iraq, okay? But with Iran, it's different. The Iranians know what we're going to do. They're planning for it. I think they're accelerating their nuclear program. They already have very accurate, sophisticated weapons that could hit the Seventh Fleet, London, Paris, and certainly Israel. So I think they would probably retaliate more in Europe and in the United States, and they already have quite a few cadres based in Venezuela, which is very close to the United States.
Well, my understanding is that they recently purchased some long-range intercontinental ballistic missiles, I suppose, 6,000, 8,000 miles. Is there any truth to that?
Well, nobody really knows. What we do know is back as early as 2001 that the North Koreans, according to CIA reports, were shipping very sophisticated missile parts in trade to fund the North Korean weapons program. But knowing what the Koreans have, they don't have the ability to barely hit Japan, so it's unlikely that they would have a missile that could go more than, I would say, 3,000 kilometers. Now, Israel is well within that range, and somewhere between Paris and London is in that range, but I doubt if they have anything more sophisticated than that.
Well, I mean, the Paris and London would certainly see those subjected to a nuclear attack. One of the major things, apparently, is the tremendous instability in Pakistan. And certainly my intelligence sources suggest that Musharraf may not be the dictator there for too much long, the military dictator, that within a year, this could be taken over by radical Islam. Is there any truth to that? Because
Yes, that is on the top of the fear list, because, as you know, under the Khan, the Pakistani nuclear engineer, under the Khan, he's the father of the Pakistan nuclear weapons. Pakistan has sophisticated missiles from North Korea and aid from China a long time ago, and that government is very unstable. There's fundamentalists still in the intelligence services, a lot in the military, a lot in the diplomatic corps. They are certainly pro-Bin Laden. They're anti-American. But we have a very strong ally that supplies very good intelligence, and that's India. And a few years ago, when India and Pakistan, if you remember, were ready to go at it, the United States negotiated the settlement. And both countries were threatening to use nuclear weapons against each other over Kashmir and over various elements of what was going on in the war of terrorists. But you're right, that Pakistani government is extremely shaky.
And of course, the thing is, my fear is that if we attack Iran, that it's going to give impetus for the radical Muslims, the members of Muslim Brotherhood or Al Qaeda, talk what you will, in Pakistan, to seize control of that government with their nuclear weapons and their sophisticated missiles. That, to me, is a very, very frightening scenario.
Well, I think the Indians wouldn't put up with that. It's something the United States probably would not be involved with. The Indian government will not put up with a radical Islamic state in Pakistan.
So what will they do with the attack?
They could do a preemptive strike. They've threatened Pakistan before.
Well, of course.
But one thing that's going on now between Pakistan and India that's very positive, they are engaging in daily diplomatic talks. They've opened up different roads. There's a lot of positive signs that are going on. And the Pakistani government, is, with U.S. help, is trying to weed out the radical Islamists in the Pakistani intelligence service and the military.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this afternoon is Mr. John Quirk, and we're talking really about what's going on in the Middle East, and I think as we look and see what's going on there, we see the potential for a very real problems there. And certainly, do you think that we're ever going to be able to win the Muslims back to the point where we're more or less on friendly relations? Certainly, you know, go back 5 years, we were in fairly good relationships with most Muslim countries. I think after 9/11, Muslims throughout the world were very sympathetic with America. What happened to that sympathy?
Well, I think what's happened is there, we still have good relations with Turkey, Egypt, Tunisia, Morocco. We have Algeria is getting very close to the United States. We have special forces troops based there. We help them defeat their terrorist problem down in the southern part of Algeria. Libya has opened up the door, and they've been very, very cooperative. There's American companies and military in Libya. Libya has supplied us with over 60 containers of information. They're in Tennessee now on the Pakistani Iranian nuclear programs. We do have trouble with countries like Sudan and Chad, Somalia and Ethiopia, but we have fairly good relations with today. We may not like them with Saudi Arabia. Our relations with Jordan are good. Yemen, so-so, but Indonesia, so-so, but I think that what we've realized after 9/11 and what Muslim countries have realized is that they must eradicate their own Islamic fundamentalist problem. It's a threat to secular Muslim countries as much as it is to Europe, America, and Western civilization. And I think that their intelligence services and military have the Muslim Brotherhood under control in Egypt. They're rooting out a lot of terrorist groups in Morocco, Tunisia. Libya doesn't have the problems it used to have. Saudi Arabia is still a problem. Turkey has been tough on Islamic fundamentalism, and yet they're an Islamic fundamentalist type of country, but they don't want terror and they don't want trouble. I think the overall populations, the young people in these countries, hate the United States. And they've listened to a lot of propaganda about us. They think, you know, it's a problem of religion insinuating itself into politics. And I think you're going to see more and more religion, Islam, insinuated into governments in the Mideast. And it's up to the Mideast countries.
Hold that thought there for just a minute. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Mr. Quirk was simply saying that it is many of the younger people there in the Muslim countries that are embracing this radical form of Islam, and that certainly something's going to have to be done to control that. He was listing, of course, the countries that, you know, are already, of course, are on our side, countries like Turkey, but, of course, if they had a free election tomorrow, the radical Islam would win, wouldn't it?
Yes, well, it did. I mean, it is. It's not radical Islam. It's fundamentalist in Turkey, but they've been very, very secular. You know, I mean, it's not like Hamas, which is a threat, winning a democratic election, or even Hugo Chavez, who is an evil person that's won a democratic election. So this is another problem the United States has to confront. How do you deal with radical people and radical organizations that win democratically. This is a new challenge for America.
Well, of course, in Turkey they may hold elections, but the military is in control. They can get all the people elected they want to, but the military, I mean, the parliament is totally under the control of the radical Islam, but the military government maintains control. Just the same thing in Algeria. We talk about democracy, but we really wouldn't want a majority vote, rule in any of those countries, would we?
Well, you know, no. I mean, it's not our place in certain countries to criticize the countries if they're not democratic. In the case of Turkey, they're very pro-American. We can only hope that whether it's 20 or 50 years that they move towards democracy. It's the same thing in Algeria. You know, you have a very strong, powerful country that's an important country, it's in North Africa, but it's an important Islamic country. We want them to be pro-U.S., and hopefully they will change. But it's a feature of the Mideast. You have no democratic countries. Morocco's moving towards democracy, but very, very slow. So it's a conundrum for the United States. It's a problem.
Didn't they kill about a million people in Algeria, putting down those people who won the democratic election, and we didn't like the democratic results, so they killed a million people?
Well, I don't know if it was a million people. I've seen figures of 150,000 to 200,000, but most of those people were directed by fundamentalist cells and had relations with Salafists in the southern Algeria, and they were linked to Al-Qaeda, and the government was fighting them for probably 15 years. So I wouldn't say those people that were defeated were embracing democracy. They were terrorists.
I see. But I thought they had elections there, and the fundamentalists won, and then they just sort of negated the results of the election.
Yeah, they won in certain local elections.
I see.
They didn't win in the national elections. The national elections in Algeria, which, I mean, are controlled by the military and the nomenclature, the apparatchiks there that have been in power since Algeria became independent in the late 50s, it will never give up power, at least in the next few years. It's really a one-party system.
Okay, well, now what about Venezuela? Because I know you feel very close to what's happening there. And here we have Hugo Chavez, who is obviously a Marxist, who hates America, and he won, at least apparently, a democratic election. What are we going to do about that? Because he actually has a liaison with Al-Qaeda, doesn't he? And isn't he working with the Iranian mullahs?
Yes, he is actually our biggest national security threat. It's not North Korea. It's not Iran. It's Venezuela. I lived there many years, and, you know, FARC operates there, the Colombian Marxist guerrillas. The Cubans control the Venezuelan military, political campaigns, and their intelligence services. They work against us here. The Venezuelan government works against us here. They're funding these Bolivarian movements in Oregon and Washington and Virginia, as well as Panama and Nicaragua. The Chinese are building two megaports and an oil pipeline. But the big problem is not only the fact that he's embraced Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah operates there. Hamas was there last week. They plan to set up an office. Is that he's invited Iranian nuclear physicists, engineers into the IVIC facility. This is a Venezuelan nuclear facility. The other problem is you're dealing with a man that doesn't believe in traditional foreign policy, okay? He is labeled a Marxist. I doubt if he's ever read a book on Marx. You know, he listens to lectures by his mentor, Fidel Castro, and he's trying to build a leftist movement all over Latin America. That is a problem in itself. The biggest problem, he really believes that a small group of terrorists based somewhere in Latin America can deploy a nuclear weapon in America and destroy us.
Now, my understanding is that that Lula there in Lulu, whatever his name is,
Lula.
In Brazil, they're actually going to start enriching uranium here within the next few months or years.
Yes, well, they've talked about it with Brazil, Argentina. The Venezuelans are already enriching uranium for the Iranians. And the Iranians are moving more and more into Venezuela. They see Venezuela as our soft underbelly. And the American embassy and our attachés are under 24-hour surveillance. Chavez has moved to make the country more of a Marxist country. And it's unbelievably ironic because we buy 14.8% of our oil from Venezuela, and we're paying him to fund all these things against us. The big problem with Chavez is that, like Hitler, he's on a schedule. Okay, Hitler, if you look back at history and you say, well, why didn't Hitler wait longer before he invaded Czechoslovakia and started the war in Poland and started to decimate the Jews of Europe? Why didn't he wait five more years until he had more sophisticated weapons? Okay, well, he was on a time clock. He was under pressure to do something to take over the world. Chavez is on a time clock with one goal, to see the United States destroyed. That's how sick he is and how evil. Now, he was democratically elected, okay? Now, there's no doubt about that. There was some fraud, but the majority of the poor voted for him. The majority of the middle class and the wealthy in Venezuela, who haven't fled there, we have about 200,000 of them in the United States, maybe more, they just abstained. They just were completely apathetic about democracy. And there was tremendous corruption before Chavez got in. The corruption under the capitalist governments were the catalyst to a man like Chavez getting elected and becoming president and dismantling democracy. Now, recently, he's bought $3 billion worth of Russian equipment. He bought millions of American equipment we had sold to the Spanish, defensive equipment. And he's acting like America is going to invade him, when in fact what he's doing is giving sustenance and aid to terrorist groups, Arab terrorist groups that are based in Venezuela.
And I think that's so important for our listeners to know that there are Arab terrorist groups based in Venezuela, and certainly this would be a wonderful area for them to stage, bringing nuclear weapons into the United States across our unguarded southern border.
That is our biggest threat, Stan. The biggest threat is from Venezuela, not Iran, not North Korea. Al-Qaeda trains on the Isle of Margarita. Hezbollah's there, Hamas. And this is interesting, all the bad actors, FARC, the Colombian terrorists, the Chinese for some reason, and I think it's Hezbollah, and elements of Al-Qaeda, although they don't wear name bands that say Al-Qaeda, have just opened up a liaison office at the Euro building in downtown Caracas. And of course, the Cuban Intelligence Service, which is first class, protects them. They've taught Chavez great counterintelligence against the American services. They've put out lots of disinformation, which we've investigated and found out not to be true. But the one area that they haven't put disinformation out is, why are the Iranians at the IVIC nuclear facility in Caracas?
And I think that's a very good question. I don't think the average American has any semblance, any idea at all. It's a lot closer to lob a missile into the United States from Venezuela than it is from Iran.
We receive thousands of containers every day from Venezuela, the ports of Maracaibo and LaGuardia in Miami, in Jacksonville, Florida, and other places. Very few are inspected. And this will give you a little interesting note, a piece of intelligence. About 3 weeks ago, the Pentagon established a new department. It's a forensic atomic or nuclear department. And what it is, basically, they're hiring people that if a nuclear bomb goes off in America, they run out and pick up pieces of what's left and try to trace it back to where it really came. What that department really is, it's warning countries like Venezuela that if you think you can covertly help a terrorist group deploy a nuclear weapon in the United States, you will still face retaliation. And this is one of Chavez's goals. He believes that if he covertly helps a terrorist group the United States would never retaliate against a democracy like Venezuela, who've been our friends for many years. But I advise he is the biggest national security threat that we have.
Well, of course, the other thing, of course, is this almost irrational individual who leads Iran today, and I know that you've looked into this secret society, the so-called 12ers group, that seem to be wanting to provoke a war. I mean, this is the most irrational thing I've ever heard, and yet they believe if they can bring chaos to the world, that they'll be able to bring the return of the Mahdi.
Yes, that's very much on the top of the Iranian list. Now, no one really knows. Our intelligence isn't that good. Nobody knows how much influence they have on the ruling party in Iran. They have cadres in the military, the intelligence services. But, you know, the Iranians are pretty smart people. They've had a Persian culture for thousands of years, and they do not want it destroyed by an Israeli nuclear attack or an American nuclear attack or even a conventional attack. But again, you have religion, you know, and whether it's fundamentalists that are Christians or fundamentalist Hasidim Lubavitchers that influence the Israeli government, or whether it's these Mahdi, you know, people, the doomsday sect, you have more and more religion influencing political decision-making, and so it's very scary.
Well, I think one of the things is the remarks of the president of Iran, which are totally irrational. We should wipe Israel off the face of the map. Israel, you know, the Holocaust didn't happen. We ought to wrap Israel up and send it off to Europe. None of this makes sense. These are not the words of a rational man. These are the words of a man who is doing everything he can to provoke an Israeli attack on his country so that, of course, they could retaliate in like form. I mean, we're living in a world where we have military leaders and government leaders who are really quite mad and irrational. And I would say that the leader of Iran and the leader of Venezuela and in many other countries throughout the world are not looking at the world from a rational point of view.
No, nor, and add North Korea to that. So, yes, and it's very difficult to penetrate these societies, to have human intelligence on the ground. Our technical services like the NSA, the National Reconnaissance Office, do a very good job. I live, as you know, in France, and I'm in touch with the Israeli opposition, who have probably been penetrated by Iranian intelligence. And they have a different culture, and they have a different goal of the world. And the United States, not Europe, but the United States is one of the only countries that has the will to stop them.
Well, what's going to happen in Israel now that now we have Hamas has taken over Palestine, and of course these people are totally irrational. They have one goal, and that's the destruction of Israel.
Yes.
Are we going to let that happen? What's going to happen?
No, and I don't think the Israelis are going to let it happen. They've been very quiet about what has happened in Iran. They are, I would say, in somewhat shock about Hamas. They've cut off their funding. I don't think, you know, Hamas may play some games over the next 24 months that they want to negotiate, but I don't think the average Israeli sees peace in the near future. And I don't think you can have peace until Syria and Iran are removed from the chessboard. You can't have peace between the Palestinians because Iran funds part of Hamas and Hezbollah, two terrorist organizations, until Iran changes the regime and Syria. And I think there's a potential for the removal of both of those regimes without the nuclear option and without a massive war.
But
maybe,
course,
I'm wrong.
What about the relationship between Iran and China? China has developed a very close relationship with Iran because they want their oil, and certainly Russia seems to be doing everything they can to supply, for instance, Iran with aircraft missiles that can be used to take down our planes. It almost looks like we're preparing for a massive war there, and both Russia and China are going to be helping Iran.
Well, you know what I call it? I call it the four C's, the letter C. With adversaries and allies in today's world, we have cooperation, we have competition on certain issues, and we have crisis and conflict. In terms of Russia is dismantling democracy. Old KGB runs most of the local provincial governments, thanks to Putin. Putin has two sources of revenue, energy to Europe, which he can use as an extortionate form of national security policy, and they sell arms to everybody. Our big future threat is China, and China has not helped us with the recent negotiations with North Korea. We thought they would help. They have not. China's ultimate foreign policy goal is to push the United States out of the Pacific, and we're not going. They are expanding all their shipping lanes and port facilities in the Caribbean and Latin America. And then the United States did something this year which kind of solidified the Chinese against America. For the first time, the United States came together, intelligence community, State Department, military, lobby groups, and they said, China is an enemy. They are an adversary. Even though they're buying our products, they're paying us, they're developing a market economy, they are throwing more and more of their resources into missile development, which in 2 years can hit California. They're funding a Blue Water Navy. They have some very, very strange behavior with the Muslim world. And they are reaching out all over the world to dominate us economically.
But then why are we lending them massive amounts of money? And why are American corporations going in and building up their military potential? And why is the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank and the Agency for International Development giving them massive loans for all things to build a nuclear power plant? Why are we building up the best enemy money could buy?
Well, we lost the technology battle with the Chinese. During the Cold War with the Russians, American companies did not go into Russia to set up businesses, okay? Walmart wasn't doing things in Russia. We've lost the technology transfer. They are an economic juggernaut we will never be able to stop.
Well, let's hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with John Quirk. And what you're hearing, ladies and gentlemen, is very, very important. Well, this is Dr. Stan. We've got three more minutes with John Quirk. And so what message would you like to leave with our listeners today? Because I think we've covered the world, and it looks to me like we are sitting really on the verge of some very serious things.
Well, I'm an optimist. I think the United States is moving back into a multilateral diplomatic position. I think Europe is going to ally with us. The goals, eventually maybe Russia will come back with us to fight fundamentalist terrorists around the world. I think we have to keep negotiating with the Chinese, hope that they democratize, and it doesn't look like they are democratizing. And unfortunately, I mean, national security, I teach a course on national security, and I said national security starts domestically. We have to help our own people, our minorities, our health care, our own economy, as you've alluded to, and so on. But right now, the best thing we can do, and people don't like to hear this, is we have to have a strong military, a strong technology, and a strong missile defense, and a strong intelligence community. Because we have people out there that want to destroy our religion, our civilization, and they're jealous of our lifestyles. And until that goes away, you cannot beat your weapons into plowshares. And I keep going back, and I thank God so much for Ronald Reagan, because he saw this 25 years ago. He saw the rise of China. He saw terrorism. And I think we'll come through it all. And I think that we are going to form new alliances. We're going to keep negotiating diplomatically. Maybe we have to give more aid, like a Marshall Aid plan to the Mideast, who knows. But right now, the main thing we have to do is keep weapons of mass destruction out of this country. And it's a tremendous challenge when you have a lot of bad actors like Iran, Venezuela, North Korea, and terrorists that want to take us down.
And I think that really is a very, very real possibility. I think the average American has never thought of America coming under direct attack. We saw the 9/11, but you know that was just an aberration. But I really share your concern for the use of weapons of mass destruction from right here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is the one area that the Bush administration hasn't sold the public on, that there is a real possibility of a nuclear weapon being deployed here. What you're going to start to see now is you're going to start to see more articles about this, and this is the way the articles are going to go. It's just a matter of time before it happens.
Hey, we're out of time, but I want to thank you very much, and I do hope maybe we can get you onto one of our other programs before you go back.
My pleasure.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, while we were talking there, Mr. Quirk was just saying he is certain that we are going to see weapons of mass destruction. It's not a matter of if, it's when they're going to hit the United States. And I would simply ask, if this is a real threat, and I believe it is, why is it the Bush administration steadfastly refuses to buy the weapons that would save the lives of millions of Americans if there was a nuclear attack on America? This was beautifully brought out on 60 Minutes a few weeks ago, and if you'd like to see that article, we could make you a copy of it. They will not, absolutely will not do anything to save the lives of millions of Americans. So much of what's going on really doesn't make sense unless there is another factor. There's an X factor. I'd studied what was going on in America for 20 years before I stumbled across the X factor, a book called The Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow, and we still carry it. And that, of course, eventually led to my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, and, of course, to the video we put together, the new video that we're offering now. Actually, it's in DVD form, called The Secret History of America's Beginning, The New Atlantis. The Secret History of America's Beginning, The New Atlantis. It's put together by our good friend Chris Pinto, who will be our guest tomorrow evening for 2 hours. And it goes into the background, the fact that there really are secret societies. You'll see the Rosicrucian Temple over in San Jose, just across the hills from where I live, and the Center for Psychological Research there in Southern California. And there really is so much going on today. And there really are secret societies, and they have a plan to plunge the world into chaos. And there's even a branch of this over in Iran, and the president of Iran is part and parcel of this, as are the mullahs over there. And they're called the Twelvers. If you want to know more about them, we'll be glad to send you an article, the Arnold de Borgrave article. You need to get the DVD, The Secret History of America's Beginning. You need to get my my video. It's called Iraq, the Untold Story, and it comes with a syllabus. You need to get my DVD or video, Planned Population Reduction. And all of these things are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. I do hope many of you will want to get my pamphlets. There are three of them. They're only $9.95 for all three, called The Occult Hierarchy. We'll give you the background of these organizations and the secret societies which have always been here and, of course, interlocked throughout the world and the governments of the world, and they have a different agenda. They want another cataclysmic war, and out of that they hope, of course, will come the New World Order and the New World Religion. Of course, the Jews wait for the return of their Messiah. The Muslims wait for the return of the Mahdi. The Hindus wait for the return of Maitreya. We wait for the return of Jesus Christ. But Jesus Christ, I'm sure, is not going to come until, of course, the man of sin has been exposed. And I believe we are moving rapidly towards that situation today. We live in a utopian society, but I fear the utopia that we live in may soon become a nightmare. Our plea with you is get informed. Help us educate the American people. There is no way this is going to be turned back unless there is a massive revival in America and the American people turn back to God. But I don't see much evidence of it, and I certainly don't hear this message coming from the leaders of this country who just say, oh, we've got to follow the administration. We have a Christian administration that treats everybody well, and it's all those wicked Muslims, and yet we're leaving our southern border open. We are specifically not doing anything at all to prepare our people for the possibility of a nuclear attack, nor getting the medicine that would save millions of lives. And, of course, you'll want to get our latest newsletters. We just go down the list of all the unexplainable things that are happening today that suggest that maybe the war on terrorism is not what we think it is. I mean, why would we have disbanded the Iraqi army's police force and civil service over there and created the chaos so that we couldn't bring our men home. Ladies and gentlemen, our number 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty. Good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please don't call unless we ask for your calls, because we're going to have a fascinating two-hour program with Chris as we begin to look at the background of what's really going on in the world today. And as you look at so many of the things that are happening, they just don't make sense. For instance, here we're told we're involved in the war on terrorism, and Osama bin Laden is the arch enemy of the United States. And yet, if you go back in 90s and certainly up until 2001, both the Clinton administration and the Bush administration actually financed Afghanistan, which of course was the Taliban, from the time it was created in 1994, right up until the September 11, 2001 attack. And in fact, when President Bush gave his speech on the 20th of September following the 9/11 attack, his address to the nation, he commented that America was the largest source of humanitarian aid for Afghanistan, which was really nothing more than financing the Taliban. And yet, of course, they knew that the Taliban were hosting and supporting and protecting Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And, of course, Osama bin Laden had been involved in the 1992 attack in Aden, in the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center, in the 1994 attack in Somalia, the Black Hawk Down incident, and then certainly the attack on our embassies in 1988 and the attack on the USS Cole in the year 2000. And Osama bin Laden had publicly declared war on America in 1996 and 1998. So why were we funding the Taliban that was hosting and giving sanctuary to Osama bin Laden for many years? Why would that happen? And why didn't the United States try to take Osama bin Laden out after he declared war on America and they were killing Americans throughout the world? A lot of questions really don't make sense. And, of course, as we see what's going on today, why we see our government turning over control of a number of our ports, six major ports in Miami and in Baltimore and in New York and in New Jersey and certainly in Boston and in Philadelphia. Why are we turning our ports over to a company that's owned by the Emirates of Dubai, which had actually recognized the Taliban? Certainly was not. It was one of the three countries that had recognized the Taliban. Why would that be happening, and why are we seem to be increasingly drawn into a war with Iran and Syria? I thought we were fighting Al Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. So why are we going to war with Iran? Well, you can't really understand so much of what's going on today until you understand that there are spirits of forces and secret societies working behind the scenes. And with us tonight is Chris Pinto, who has put together one of the most amazing DVDs I've ever seen. It's called The Secret History of America's Beginning, The New Atlantis. And when we get back, we'll talk to you more about this incredible DVD. I just got, it just came out last Friday. I got a copy on Saturday. We watched it on Sunday. It's almost 3 hours. My wife, who very seldom sits and just watches a television program, she usually reads at the same time because she can do three things at once. And she was transfixed by this DVD, and as was I. And my son, of course, we watched this together. And we'll tell you more in a few minutes. Well, Chris, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thanks for having me, Dr. Stan. It's always good to come on with you.
Well, I think that it's such an important subject because the idea that there really have been secret societies, that they really, of course, do influence the affairs of men, this really is so, it's a foreign idea to most people today.
Yeah, it is. In fact, a lot of people are, because they don't make the connection of the secret societies, a lot of things that they see the Bush administration doing doesn't seem to make any sense. But unless we understand what motivates them, like what's compelling them to do the things that they're doing, it's very difficult to figure out a lot of the left and right and confusing signals and moves that not only the Bush administration but other administrations have made over the decades.
And of course, they try to make us think there's a battle between the Republicans and the Democrats, the right and the left, the conservatives and the liberals. But, of course, so much of this is simply play acting. So much of this is smoke and mirrors, rhetoric over reality. Until people understand that there really are secret societies that are directing the course of mankind and moving it towards a one-world government and a new world religion, and most of what's going on today It doesn't make sense. Now, were you well aware of these things before you actually teamed up with David Bay to make this story?
Yeah, these were issues that the documentary we just finished, Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings, Volume 1, The New Atlantis. The whole New Atlantis concept and the Great Atlantean Plan, as it's called, is something that I had come across when I was doing research for Megiddo, Part 1 on Bible Prophecy and the New World Order. And I had come across all of this stuff on the just this plan that dates back to Sir Francis Bacon, and really much farther than Francis Bacon, dates back even to the time of Plato and his writing the Atlantis dialogue in the Critias. But that the secret societies, as Manly P. Hall writes in The Secret Teachings of All Ages, and also in The Secret Destiny of America, he writes that secret societies have for some 3,000 years been planning or plotting to rebuild somehow the lost empire of Atlantis. And of course you could debate whether this is going to be a literal Atlantis or a spiritual or metaphorical Atlantis, but it definitely is a utopian concept.
I want you to hold that thought.
Sure.
Right now, we'll be right back again. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Chris Pinto, and we're talking about a new DVD, and he is actually was the producer of this, or at least he wrote the script. He put it together, he directed it, along with David Bay. And those of you who don't know what David Bay has a ministry called Cutting Edge. It's on the Internet. He does an excellent job, and he does, certainly on the printed page, what we try to do on the radio, and that is try to introduce people into the fact that there really are secret societies. Now, Chris has put together this excellent DVD. It's called The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning. The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning, Part 1, The New Atlantis. And this idea, why don't you repeat again this idea of what is this New Atlantis? Where did this idea come from? Because, most people have heard of Lost Atlantis, but the New Atlantis?
Yeah, the idea of the New Atlantis dates back to Sir Francis Bacon in the 16th and 17th century. Really, the 17th is he didn't really finish it, but when he was writing The New Atlantis, and then it was published posthumously after his death by friends of his.
And he died, what, about 1626, somewhere
1626,
there?
1626, yeah.
Right, okay.
And so The New Atlantis was published shortly thereafter, and is considered by, men like Masonic writers like Manly P. Hall, who claims that this is kind of the blueprint for all the secret societies. Masonry, Rosicrucianism, it will even extend into the Skull and Bone Society that was founded, I believe, in the 19th century. And that this is the underlying purpose of all of these societies that Manly Hall referred to as the Order of the Quest, collectively. They're all ultimately pursuing this utopian dream to build a single world order that will be like paradise on Earth. And in our documentary, we have a Baconian expert, a man named Peter Dawkins, who's studied Bacon for about 33 years under an organization called the Francis Bacon Research Trust over in England. And he's actually affiliated with the chief Masonic, the pro grand master of British Freemasonry over in England. And this person, a guy named the Marquis de Northampton, who is affiliated with the royal family, he's the acting head of British Freemasonry, and he supports the work of Peter Dawkins. And Dawkins not only is supported by Northampton, but also teaches at the Globe Theater there in London, which is dedicated to the works of Shakespeare and so on. And, of course, one of the things that we get into in our documentary is the long-held belief that Sir Francis Bacon and his secret society are the real authors of the Shakespeare plays, primarily Bacon, but but with some of his fellow artists and poets as well. And that the plays were developed, along with a number of other literary works, to transform the English language and to prepare English-speaking people to come and colonize the New World, so that they would have a language by which they could incorporate all of the ancient wisdom of the ancient world. And Bacon dedicated his whole life to importing all the Greek and the Roman and the ancient mystery writings and so on, so that they would be available to English-speaking people, which is, I believe, at least from the research that I've done, the reason why in our school system today, all of these ancient works, the writings of Homer and the writings of Plato and the teachings of Aristotle and so on, and all the works of Shakespeare are generally required reading at some point in our education system. And it's something that was developed very specifically. It wasn't just an accident. Bacon knew very much what he was doing. Bacon coined the phrase, knowledge is power. And he believed that by empowering English-speaking people with knowledge, that they would advance, and he launched this movement that he called the Advancement of Learning, that they would advance and flourish in the New World and ultimately spread throughout the world and establish this utopian empire that would be, if you will, the New Atlantis. The concept, of course, dates back to at least Plato, the concept that Atlantis had been this perfect system. And depending upon which writer you get hold of, like Manly Hall believed that Atlantis was a mighty empire that extended to the whole world, that it was this philosophic commonwealth. And he writes about this, and he writes about the dream of democracy and how democracy was the hidden concept within all the secret societies, and that they carried this idea of democracy one generation after another. And of course we know in the ancient world that the ancient kingdoms were ruled by kings and queens and monarchies and so on. And so the idea of democracy was, in reality, especially if you study the ancient world and through the Dark Ages, democracy was considered the enemy, of the monarchical system. And the idea of educating the common man was considered to be very dangerous, to give knowledge to the masses. Well, then if you gave them knowledge, then they might be enlightened, and then they might rise up, and they might gain an advantage over you. And so kings and queens and princes and so on didn't really want the common man educated. But Bacon, it would seem from what he did, recognized that this was essential to building his concept of paradise on earth. And this utopian concept of rebuilding paradise, as Bacon saw it, is essentially the plan for the New World Order. And that's what we try to point out in our documentary, that the New Atlantis, paradise on earth, that is the driving motivation behind secret societies and this New World Order plan.
And of course, Francis Bacon was a Rosicrucian. Knights of the Rosy Cross. And of course, this was been their idea. The Rosicrucians had been around several hundred years by the time Francis Bacon was living. But the Rosicrucians were simply carrying on the tradition of the Templars, who were carrying on the traditions of the ancient Magi. And then, of course, going. And you have to understand, of course, so much of Greek philosophy was based upon the writings of Pythagoras, who preceded Socrates, who preceded Plato, who preceded Aristotle, who preceded Alexander the Great, who set out to conquer the whole world. But it was all based upon the occult. Plato taught certain things, and what he wrote, why they were written in a way that there could be several interpretations of them. One, of course, for the common people like you and me, and then the other for the elite. So there always was buried within the teachings the secret message, and the secret message was really about this elite establishing this one world government. And Francis Bacon, dying in 1626, but it was his followers who came to America shortly thereafter, established the secret Rosicrucian cells here in America. And, of course, it began to corrupt and undermine the very Christian fabric of our society because there was a tremendous antagonism towards Christianity, so that by 1740, America was a totally corrupt and debased society. And then came the first Great Awakening with men like Jonathan Edwards and John Wesley, and suddenly there was a turning back to God, and out of that great revival, the first Great Awakening, the first Great Arrival, came this Christian intent upon creating a sovereign nation here. But at the very same time, and this is what most Christians and most Americans don't understand, there were these occult forces. The Rosicrucians were here too. So the Christians wanted to establish a Christian civilization, but the Rosicrucians wanted a new civilization as well, but they wanted to use that at some time in the future to bring the whole world together under the control of a ruling elite, and they wanted to establish what would be the new philosophical Atlantis. Would that be a fair statement, Chris?
Yeah, it certainly certainly would be, and Bacon, as you pointed out, him being involved with the Rosicrucians, it's believed that, you know, the Rosicrucians, depending on which version of their history you read, you can trace them all. They go back several thousand years, possibly. Some people believe they began in Germany. Others, like Peter Dawkins, argue that they really began, the modern Rosicrucian movement began in England, but there doesn't seem to be a clear agreement. The concept, though, of Rosicrucianism, which we talk about, and you say something, just so people know in case they don't know, we interview Dr. Stan in the documentary, and he does a fabulous job. But one of the things that you say in the documentary is you're talking about Rosicrucianism, and then you say, you know, most people have no idea that this organization even exists. And I talk to people all the time, you know, who call our ministry and ask questions about our other work where we're talking about Freemasonry and the Illuminati or other secret societies, but most people are largely unaware of Rosicrucianism, and they are such an influential society and have been over the centuries. They've had a huge influence on Freemasonry. And especially, I think, the ecumenical movement that's at work in the world today. Because the concept of the Rose and Cross, generally speaking, even though there's a number of interpretations, the one that seems to hit home the most is the idea that the Rose represents the ancient mystery system, while the Cross represents Christianity. And the combining or blending or infusing of these two opposing forces, that is really what Rosicrucianism does.
And of course, I thought your pictures there of the Rosicrucian Temple in San Jose, California, that, for the people who say this couldn't be true, and here you have the pictures of this Egyptian temple, much of it, Egyptian lore, right in the very heart of San Jose, California, and there's probably very, very few people have any idea what it's all about.
Yeah, it's true, Dr. Stan.
We'll be back in just a moment with Chris Pinto talking about the secret mystery of America's beginning. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Chris Pinto. We're talking about his new DVD, and I will tell you it is really gripping. But it is an excellent teaching tool, and of course there are people in it like William Still, certainly one of our favorite authors, and the Bill Snablin, who we've interviewed a number of times. And certainly, but I thought your interview with the gentleman from the other side, and by other side, I think he's a very nice man. I think he really is totally dedicated to Francis Bacon and the memory of this great Englishman, one of the most powerful men in the realm of the English realm when he lived. And I don't think he has any idea at all of the sinister aspect of what was going on. Do you?
No, that's the interesting thing about Bacon. William Still says something where he talks about how Bacon is such an interesting and such a complex character. And the gentleman you're referring to, Peter Dawkins, who I had the pleasure of spending an afternoon with there at his country home and just outside of Stratford, when we went to interview him, he and his wife were just delightful people. I mean, really some of the nicest people I've ever met. And he's very much into Bacon, and you know, he refers to Bacon as the herald of the New Age, and he's, you know, very much into Kabbalistic teachings and a lot of, you know, what we would call New Age theologies. But he is generally a very polite man, and a lot of the sinister side that we see to the New Age, I did not find when I interviewed him and in the conversations I had with him. And in a lot of the stuff that Sir Francis Bacon writes, probably one of the most confusing things about Bacon is when you read his writings, you know, there are passages of the stuff that he writes that, you know, we could attribute to somebody like Charles Spurgeon or a great, you know, English gospel teacher. You know, there are times when he's quoting scripture and he's talking about the gospel and talking about the Lord Jesus Christ and salvation and the, you know, the blood that the Lord shed on the cross and things like this that just make him come across very much, like what we would consider a convicted Christian man. But then he intermingles with his understanding, you know, the gods and goddesses of the ancient world, you know, Pallas Athena and Apollo and all of the mystery teachings and so on. And of course Bacon is believed by you know, many people like Manly Hall and Dawkins and others, especially I think in Britain, to have been the founder of modern Freemasonry. That he was the person, while, you know, Masonry had been, you know, they'd been the craft Masons and so on, then there are those who believe that they were infiltrated by the Knights Templar after their persecution, but Bacon seems to have been the man who formalized the mystery teachings into a system, you know, of that people could follow, like step one, step two, step three, and so on. And that is really where Masonry began its modern system. And shortly after, within a century of Bacon's death, official Masonry began in 1717 at the Grand Lodge in England. But it had never been officially formalized, and that seems to have been Bacon's great contribution. But prior to his founding of modern Masonry, He had become the chief of the Rosicrucian Order.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Chris Pinto, and we're talking about the new DVD they put out, and that is The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning, part one, The New Atlantis. And certainly he's talking about Francis Bacon, Sir Francis Bacon, probably a person who is not well known to the average American, and yet you find his influence everywhere in America today, because Masonry, which Sir Francis Bacon really more or less formalized and organized, even though it wasn't officially charted until 1717, but it was Francis Bacon's writings that were really the forerunners of modern-day Masonry. And modern-day Masonry is simply the present-day manifestations of the ancient mystery religions, and of course it contains the writings of the Illuminati, the writings of the Rosicrucians, of the Theosophists, and the ancient mystery religions. Until you understand, there has always been another dimension to the world. Whether it be the ancient Magi, who went to Bethlehem in search of the Jesus child, but they were aware of the writings, the ancient writings, that Jesus would be born at that time. And so they followed the star to Bethlehem. There have been two forces in the world. One, the force of our Lord, and of course the other, the dark side. And this battle has gone on since the inception of time. It is being played out with amazing clarity on the stage of today's world, and the average person doesn't understand that everything going on has a spiritual connotation, but so much of it is really founded in what Chris talks about in this amazing video, which everybody who wants to understand what's going on today will want to see. And of course, the pictures were taken at Rosslyn Chapel. Now, most people had never heard of Rosslyn Chapel until Dan Brown wrote The Da Vinci code, but the byproduct of the book was talking. Of course, it ends with the hero and the villain are in Rosslyn Chapel. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about Rosslyn Chapel and why it is so important, what it represents?
Oh, certainly. Rosslyn is a fascinating place. We went there, of course, and shot some footage. We got permission to go inside the chapel and with our camera and set up a tripod and whatnot, and even interviewed, which we show, the director of the Rosslyn Chapel Trust, a guy named Stuart Beatty, a very nice man. But Rosslyn Chapel, as far as the founding of America is concerned, because that's really what we're talking about, and Sir Francis Bacon had this concept that America, he calls in his New Atlantis, his writing, The New Atlantis, he refers to America as Atlantis. That America, this lost continent, not that it was going to become a New Atlantis, but it was the place where ancient Atlantis was. And this was an idea that was held by men like Dr. John Dee, the most learned men of that time, held this view that America was Atlantis. So the question comes about, well, where did they get this idea? Why America of all places? Why not some other island somewhere? And one of the things that we track down is the pre-Columbian knowledge of the American continent, and that's what takes us to Rosslyn Chapel. Because in Rosslyn Chapel, there are certain types of vegetation. If you study Rosslyn, and people who kind of follow the Da Vinci Code and whatnot, this information has become pretty commonplace, but still there's a lot of people who aren't aware that inside Rosslyn Chapel are carved, for example, ears of corn, Indian maize, which were not indigenous to the European continent, but they were indigenous to the American continent.
And I think it's so important that people understand Rosslyn Chapel was completed in 1492.
Yeah. So they were building it for some 50-odd years prior to, Columbus supposedly discovering America. And the question comes about, okay, how did the builders know to carve this Indian corn? Where did they get the idea of this Indian corn unless it came to them somehow from the New World? And then there's other things. There's the Aloha cactus plants, which are carved along the archways there.
And they're carved in stone. I mean, this is not something you do just overnight.
Right. And back then, as Stuart Beatty explains in the documentary, they would have gone through a long process. They would have had the original plant. They would have made drawings of it. They would have carved it into wood. All of these things would have been approved by the builders. And then they would have been carved in stone and then set in place there in the chapel. So they really took quite a bit of time. So they had to know what it was that they were carving and setting in place. And there's even a third plant that we show, a trefoil plant, which is a type of clover that one particular botanist believed was the slam dunk in terms of proving.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Chris Pinto. We're talking about the great new DVD, and of course, it's just been out just last Friday, at least in the form of where it's available. And of course, the secret mystery of America's beginning. We're talking about Rosslyn Chapel, and for those of you who haven't read the Da Vinci Code, and I'm not suggesting you go out and read it because it's really a blasphemous story. But of course, it culminates here in this small chapel. It's a Templar chapel, and of course, remember that Knights Templar were part of this whole world conspiracy. They were actually disbanded because it was found that they were Luciferian and worshiping Lucifer. And of course, people say, "Oh, that couldn't be." And yet, if you read the writings of Manly P. Hall and the ancient lectures in ancient philosophy, he makes it very clear that actually that was exactly why they had to be destroyed, because they had found the secret. they worship Lucifer. So there, of course, in the chapel, you see all the in the stone carved Templars lying there, and in various poses there, and you see all these demonic faces. I mean, that was one of the things that really interested me so much, were some of those demonic faces that looked like came right out of the pit of hell. Did you notice that?
Yeah, definitely. We, in fact, those are some of the... Now, just to clarify, Dr. Stan, if it was confusing in the documentary, I'm sorry, but the carvings of the knights on the floor holding the swords, that was actually in Temple Church, which is in London, and that is a Templar, official Templar church. Even to this day, there are Templars, that, men who consider themselves Templars that are there. But then in Rosslyn Chapel... is where we have the Indian corn and so on.
Okay, so there are no Knights Templar then in the Rosslyn Chapel.
Well, actually, in Rosslyn Chapel there is the tomb of William Sinclair, who is the ancestor of the man who built Rosslyn Chapel, another man named William Sinclair, and his tomb, when they found it, says William Sinclair, Knight Templar. Okay. So there is a Templar connection at Rosslyn Chapel, and so this leads into a lot of different theories about, okay, how did the Masons have knowledge of the New World and vegetation from the New World prior to Columbus discovering it in 1492? And then there are those who question, you know, when the Templars were persecuted, they had a fleet of ships, and their ships disappeared. And it's not completely known where they went. There's a number of theories, but one of them is that perhaps they made their way to the New World. Some people think that's far-fetched.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess this is Chris Pinto, and talking about, of course, Rosslyn Chapel over in Scotland, completed in 1492 and yet containing in it a vegetation, ears of corn, other things, depicting things that were present in the New World, and yet, of course, it was 1492 when Columbus set off to discover America. So long before Columbus ever came to America, the people who created this mysterious chapel, Rosslyn Chapel, which, of course, is immortalized in Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Codes, as this really a center of the world occult movement, and it really is, of course, that they knew so much about America long before it was discovered. And the question is, how? And Chris was saying that, well, one explanation is given is that the Templars had a fleet of ships, which disappeared after Jacques de Molay was arrested on Friday the 13th, 1307, because, of course, it had been discovered that they were Luciferians, and they had found the secret of the ages, which, of course, was the fact that Lucifer indeed is God. But go ahead.
Well, I was saying there's a number of theories about whether or not the Templars made it to the New World, and while some people think that's far-fetched, it's the evidence. I mean, for example, we point out that when Columbus went to the New World, Columbus was married to a woman whose family was apparently came from a long line of Knights Templar, and when Columbus sailed to America, he sailed with red crosses on a white background, which anyway, if you get online and you look up, you know, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria, the ships that Columbus sailed with, all the paintings will show that, you know, the white background with a red cross. Well, of course, that's the symbol of the Knights Templar. And is this all just a big coincidence? And Buff Perry, who's a professional cipher that we interview in the documentary, he talks about Columbus getting hold of these portolans and cartographs, which are types of charts and so on, and there's a lot of speculation, and of course there's evidence that Columbus himself, as Manly P. Hall believes, was a member of secret societies. And so there is speculation that the Templars probably did have some kind of access to the New World, whether they went there themselves or they knew others who went, and that they had handed this knowledge down from one generation to another. But to me, the real slam dunk on this whole thing is the research of Harvard professor Barry Fell, who uncovers along the northeast coastline all this evidence, you know, archaeological evidence, Roman coins. He's finding carvings. He's finding underground caves, all of these things that he writes about in his book, America B.C., that dates Europeans and people from the ancient world, from ancient Egypt and Carthage and Rome and so on, that had access to the New World. And the archaeological evidence is there that, yes, they did come to the New World, and there were a number of people who knew about this place. And so, as we say in the documentary, people knew about this. They knew that this land was here long before the time of Columbus. And Manly Hall's assertion in his book about the secret destiny of America is that the secret societies, they were the ones who knew about this land. And they believed that it was intended to be this launching pad for this new Atlantean dream that would lead mankind into a golden era. And so they kept it secret for centuries and centuries and centuries, waiting, you know, until it would be officially revealed or unveiled to the world. And this is the movement that we believe Sir Francis Bacon was a part of. And this is why he set his secret societies in motion with English literature, with Masonry, with Rosicrucianism, and was such a key player, along with guys like Dr. John Dee and most likely Queen Elizabeth, Sir Walter Raleigh, this whole group, sending people to the New World to colonize it, and especially to do so before it fell into the hands of Rome, and launch this new Atlantean empire from the American continent.
All right, well, let me just briefly read from Manly P. Hall, his book, The Secret Destiny of America, because, of course, what he says is so similar to what George W. Bush says. Here I'm writing, quoting from The Secret Destiny of America. World democracy was the secret dream of the great classic philosophers. Toward the accomplishment of this greatest of all human ends, they outlined programs of education, religion, and social conduct directed to the ultimate achievement of a practical and universal brotherhood. One of the most ancient of man's constructive ideas is the dream of universal democracy and a cooperation of all nations in a commonwealth of states. The mechanism for the accomplishment of this ideal was set in motion in the ancient temples of Greece, Egypt, and India. So brilliant was the plan, and so well was it administered that it has survived to our time. Now, here's Manly P. Hall, who is certainly the most brilliant of all Masonic philosophers. When he died, he was said by the Scottish Rite magazine to have been the greatest of all Masonic philosophers. And he was himself a Satanist. He worshipped Lucifer. But here's what George Bush says. As the 20th century ended, and of course, this is a talk he gave the National Endowment for Democracy on November 6, 2003, and here's George Bush. As the 20th century ended, there were about 120 democracies in the world, and I can assure you more are on the way. We've witnessed the swiftest advance of freedom in the 2,500 years story of democracy. Historians in the future will offer their own explanations for why this happened. Yet we already know some of the reasons they will cite. It is no accident that the rise of so many democracies took place in a time when the world's most influential nation was itself a democracy. Well, of course, America is not a democracy, it's a republic, so why does, of course, President Bush keep referring to democracy? Democracy. Democracy, democracy, and of course, this was the plan of the ancient secret societies, the ancient religions. And you have one wonderful quotation in there from George Bush, where you actually see him. What was that quotation? Do you recall?
Well, it's in the opening of the documentary, where we explain Manly Hall's teaching about, you know, Atlantis being this philosophic commonwealth, a democratic commonwealth that would spread democracy to all the world, and how this is something that Bacon was representing. And then we point out the Novus Ordo Seclorum, because Bacon called himself the herald of the New Age, and then we say, could this have something to do with the new order of the ages, that's on the back of the U.S. dollar bill. And then we show President Bush in his inaugural address in 2005 after he was reelected. And he says, quote, he says, when our founders declared a new order of the ages, he says they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled.
Would you mind repeating that? I think that is one of the most amazing statements. Could you repeat that for us, Chris?
Yeah, it was, when our founders declared a new order of the ages, they were acting on an ancient hope that is meant to be fulfilled.
And I think it's so important to understand that most of our founding fathers were not involved in this idea, of creating this universal democracy, but a few of them were. In fact, one of the most famous quotations that we attribute Benjamin Franklin, and people have probably heard of it, the longer I live, the more convinced I am of the fact that God rules in the affairs of men, and if a sparrow cannot fall without his knowledge, can a great empire be raised without his blessing? Well, most of our founding fathers weren't interested in raising a great empire. They wanted a Christian country that, of course, would offer freedom here in America. But there were those who, like Benjamin Franklin, was a Rosicrucian and a Mason and deeply involved in the whole occult world, who recognized that that we were creating an empire. And if you look at the emblem on the back of the dollar bill, the pyramid, cap by the all-seeing eye, and you go back and you get the story of the Great Seal of the United States, because that came from the back of the Great Seal of the United States, you'll find that there are three or four men on the original committee that created the Great Seal of the United States, which was hidden until 1935, and then when a brother, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, of course he was a 32nd degree Mason, put that on the back of the dollar bill to announce, of course, the final arrival as we move towards the establishment of this new Novo Ordo Seclorum. But Benjamin Franklin was one of the three or four people instrumental in creating that original emblem. And, of course, this is strongly occult. I mean, what's a pyramid have anything to do with America? And that all-seeing eye and the triangle, that is a symbol of the ancient mystery religions. So what's it doing on the back of the dollar bill? Unless you understand the Baconian dream, and of course the part that Sir Francis Bacon and Benjamin Franklin played in that, and the dream of a world empire, you can't understand anything going on today.
Yeah, as we point out in the two things I was gonna mention. We point out there's a Newfoundland stamp that when I saw it, I was my jaw hit the floor when I was doing the research. But there's a Newfoundland stamp that has Francis Bacon's picture on it. And it's like a 19, turn of the century stamp. And it says at the bottom, it says, Lord Bacon, the guiding spirit in the colonization scheme. And it's very interesting that at the turn of the century, there were those who had a very clear understanding that Bacon was behind this whole colonization scheme or concept. Even guys like Sir Walter Raleigh, who, the lost colony at Roanoke, and we talk, more about that in the documentary, but Raleigh was a part of the whole Baconian circle. Prior to that, Bacon was influenced by a guy named Dr. John Dee that we talk about a pretty good bit, because Dee himself was very influential in the teachings and the advancement of knowledge and science and so on that has really been such an important driving force in the new world. It is what has enabled, and we should say while we're talking about this, Dr. Stan, that Francis Bacon is considered the father of modern science, of developing the modern scientific method that pulled men out of the Dark Ages view of science and into the experimental method view that was picked up by guys like Sir Isaac Newton and John Locke and others, and even men like Benjamin Franklin, who would certainly have been influenced by Bacon's scientific method. And that's what Bacon really believed. In his New Atlantis, he's writing about this empire that has all of these wondrous scientific achievements. And it's, you know, and he's writing about a lot of things. He's writing about experiments with animals. He's writing about sound studios where, you know, you develop different types of sounds. And you can just see like a modern recording studio in his writing here that he's setting down back in the 1600s. And he's writing about, you know, tall buildings and flying machines and hospitals and healthcare centers and all of these different things that have materialized through the 19th and 20th century in America. And, of course, people who read the New Atlantis are just fascinated, like Manly Hall was, and you wonder, how did he have this such a clear and in many ways very specific, because he's not just, you know, writing about some general stuff. He's writing about some very specific elements that are very specific to the New World and most of them have all come to pass.
Well, I think that people have to understand that there is another dimension that certain people can tap into. Now, you don't want to tap into it. This is what mediums and sorcerers and true magicians, not the stage magicians, but there really are people with supernatural power. There really are people who can channel all sorts of things. Ed Casey was a channel. Monday evening, we see a program on television about a medium. It's based upon a true story of a woman who was a medium who helped a district attorney catch the bad guys. But, of course, she was tapping into the very root of hell for this knowledge. So I suspect that Mason, as with so many of the people who are into the esoteric societies, you know, really channeled a great deal of their information. Have you thought of that?
Oh, certainly. And that's what we try to bring out in a documentary. Dr. John Dee, who was the foremost scientist prior to Bacon, certainly he was. Dee was famous for communicating with angelic powers that, you know, as Christians we would easily recognize as demons. And Sir Francis Bacon was in communication with the spirit realm clearly, and we even present a quote where it would seem Bacon was in touch with a spirit calling itself Pallas Athena. The ancient Greek goddess, but that his inspiration likewise came from the spirit realm. And that's part of the backbone and the heart of Rosicrucianism, is the Rosicrucians believed, as Ian Taylor explains in Secret Mysteries, that these spirits, and some of them they acknowledged were even demons, but that they had a lot of intelligence, they had a lot of knowledge. And that if you tap into them, they can give you knowledge. And incredibly enough, as you know, Dr. Stan, some of the great scientists of the 20th century, men like Thomas Edison or Chester Carlson, who developed the Xerox machine and so on, and others, have all admitted to practicing some form of, you know, altered consciousness where they're tapping into powers from the spirit realm that are giving them the inspiration for these great scientific ideas and advancements that they come up with.
And I think that's really so important for people to understand. Thomas Edison was a disciple of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. And Helena Petrovna Blavatsky was a Luciferian. If you haven't read, I wouldn't suggest you try to read her Secret Doctrine, but in Volume 2, and we quote from it extensively in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, she tells you that Lucifer is God, that Satan is this wonderful, wonderful angel, that most people think he's bad, but he's really very, very good. And until people begin to grasp how this all fits together, they are totally incapable of understanding so much of what's going on today. For indeed, ladies and gentlemen, we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, scientific, educational, financial battlefield. You have to understand what's really going on, and once you do, why everything begins to make sense. And this DVD, and we'll tell you a little later about how you may, if you want to get more information, how you can get it, but I think Chris Pinto and David Bay have done a magnificent job in bringing this out. We'll be back here in just a moment as we wrap up at least the first hour of our program here with Chris Pinto talking about the new DVD. It's entitled The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do have on the line from Santa Cruz, Mike, and Mike knows a great deal about the occult, having been involved in it for many years. And when I saw the this new DVD, I thought of Mike, because this gets into the ley lines and the energy lines upon which so many of our cities are laid out. And Mike, did you have a question or comment?
Well, first of all, I can't wait to see the film and the video. But yeah, two things. I wanted, does Chris know anything about Sir Francis Bacon's involvement in the translation of the King James Version of the Bible?
I do know something. I can tell you what I know. There are some, like Manly Hall, who would say that he believes, and he says this in his Secret Teachings of All Ages, that he believes Bacon was behind the whole King James translation. Not that Bacon himself did the translation, because the translators are well known, but Bacon was Lord Chancellor of England during the era of King James, who's, you know, officially authorized the King James Version. And Bacon was very close to King James. And there is historical evidence that Bacon did want because he was very much into promoting English literature, and he really did believe in the teachings of the Bible. Now, he took a Kabbalistic approach to it, but he believed, he really wanted a very good Bible for the English people. So it's very possible that Bacon was influential. But according to Peter Dawkins, when I interviewed him, and Dawkins is considered by a lot of people, even by, I would get in touch with some of the foremost Baconian people, and I would try to get interviews with them, and they would tell me, well, you know, if you can get in touch with this guy, Peter Dawkins, he's really the one to talk to. And Dawkins has written like 14 books on Bacon anyway. Dawkins says there is no specific evidence that Bacon was directly involved with the translation of the King James Bible. If anything, Bacon, according to Dawkins, might have been the guy that they went to after the translation was done to smooth out the language in English, to make it all poetic and flow all the way through. But Dawkins asserts that in no way did Bacon translate the work, if you will. But at this time, many English words were being developed. There were a lot of new words being developed and so on. Words were being crafted and so on. And Bacon was an expert in language and ciphers and secret codes and all this kind of stuff, and his whole literary group.
You're going to have to hold that thought, and sure, we'll get to it later. Thanks so much, Mike. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're really dependent on those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day, and then with a weekend program as well, trying to make people understand what this is about. We're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. Will it survive? Well, I have no way of knowing. But I will tell you, we're reaching rapidly at the climax of history. And, of course, if God is just, and you see what's going on in America, his justice will not sleep forever. Well, we do hope that many of you will perhaps want to know more about the DVD we're talking about, The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning. If you'd like more information, the telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Chris has done two other great videos, which we are DVDs, which we really, I think, are exceptional. One of them is called Megiddo 1, and the other is called Megiddo 2, and I do play a small part in Megiddo 2, and a small part in, a very small part in The Secret Mystery, and I'm so actually pleased to be there, because there are some excellent other people in the interviews with Peter Dawkins, who seems like the nicest sort of man, and the just everything about this is so professionally done. The music is so well done, the background, the research, and I certainly want to congratulate both Chris and David Bay, who, of course, was able to provide the funding so that Peter, so that Chris could do such a good job. And I think you'll be enthralled by this. And as I said at the beginning of the program, my wife ordinarily can do at least two, sometimes three things at one time. I'm constantly amazed by her, but she almost never watches a television program without reading something else at the same time. And after about 15 minutes, she put down everything and just sat entranced, as I was this last Sunday evening, as we watched this incredible story unfolding, the story which really goes into the background of what's going on behind the scenes. And if you begin seeing what's happening as we're being drawn into a war in the Middle East, it really doesn't make sense. I mean, why, if we went into Afghanistan to catch wicked Osama bin Laden, then why did we invade Iraq? And why are we going to war with Iran and Syria? Unless you understand that behind everything going on are these powerful spiritual forces and the secret societies. And, of course, our president belongs to a secret society. He's sworn these horrible oaths to this this society that is based upon skull and bones, and there are all sorts of skulls and bones there in the secret tomb at Yale University. And of course, you could find, if you study skull and bones, it ties into the intelligence agencies going back, 100 years or more. But of course, into banking, into power. This all has to do, of course, with control. Behind all of the secret societies is a common goal: the creation of a new world order and a new world religion. So you begin to tie everything together, and you begin to understand that you can't understand anything at all unless you understand the secret societies. They hide their emblems in plain sight, on the television screens, on the back of the dollar bill. So please pray for America and pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Stand back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line Chris Pinto, who has put together, along with David Bay, one of the most amazing videos I've ever seen, because, of course, it explains what's really going on today. Now, you can watch the Discovery Channel and the History Channel and all the things that are controlled by the other side. These are not there to reveal what's going on. They're there to conceal what's going on. Occasionally, you'll catch a little glimpse of the truth. I remember the History Channel, did do some excellent programs on the occult background of the Third Reich, and of course, Helena Petrovna Blavatsky and her relationship to Adolf Hitler. Once in a while, you'll get something right there. They can't censor everything, but here, in 3 hour, almost a 3 hour production, you are going to get tremendous insight into at least one of the secret societies, if certainly the secret society that was so instrumental in creating the background of America. And then, of course, as America turned from its Christian background towards the occult background, because there are always two forces in America. One was the Christian, one was the occult. The occult was always here. It was very powerful. It worked secretly behind the scenes, promoting itself into key positions. The Christians were there, trying, of course, to maintain a Christian society. But by the time FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, had actually finished his term in office, the occultists, the Masons, were in total control. They controlled our Supreme Court. And from 1941 until 1971, during which years they took God and prayer out of our schools and began to centralize all power in Washington, D.C., the Masons were in total control of the United States Supreme Court, and they permeate every aspect of our society today. And so one of the things that Chris actually talks about are the ley lines. Would you like to talk a little bit about that, Chris? I thought that was so fascinating that the average individual has never actually grasped the fact that everything is laid out in astrological terms.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty fascinating too, Dr. Stan. We managed to get an interview with a guy named Jim Allison, who's a lawyer in Alabama. And he's got a website up on the internet where he talks about what he calls these great circles that encompass the earth. And upon these circles are all of the ancient monuments that are built. And he mentions things like Easter Island and the pyramids in Egypt and Stonehenge and a host of sites around the world, many of which I'd never even heard of before, but it's just amazing. And it so clearly supports, I believe, the history of the world given by the Bible, how everybody was unified at Babel, and then the cultures were scattered and by God, and then all of these incredible cultures sprang up around the world, and they had so many things in common, and one of them was this building technique that they had of building these towers or pyramids or places of worship that were built upon these lines, or ley lines as they're called, that are believed to be kinds of lines of power in the earth. And so they build things on these ley lines, thinking that they'll be empowered by the spirit realm and perhaps by the earth itself.
And, of course, that's really so much of the lore of the pyramid. There is secret power there, tapping into the dark side. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Chris Pinto. Chris, why don't you pick up the story of the ley lines? And really, people do not understand that Stonehenge is specifically laid out in a very, very specific manner. So that, at a certain time, at the time of the spring and the fall equinox, the sun will rise exactly over in between the two of the posts of the trilithon, over the top of this stone that rises in front of the altar there. How could they possibly have done that thousands of years ago? How could they possibly have moved those gigantic stones? Not only moved them to that site, but actually have lifted them into place. Unless, of course, they were tapping into supernatural power that could actually levitate stones into place. Is this possible? Could things like that happen? Well, of course, they'll give you all sorts of mechanical ways that they built the Great Pyramids, and they lifted these stones from the that there in the Stonehenge. But there is another alternative, and that is they were tapping into mysterious power to do this. That is why the Druids, who hold their regular ceremonies there, and of course, you remember one of the most famous Druids of modern times was a man named Winston Churchill, who always had a good press. So pick up the story there.
Well, the ley lines that are mentioned, that we talk about in the documentary, that pertain to all the ancient monuments, places like Stonehenge, the pyramids, Easter Island, and so on, one of these ley lines are great circles that is said to encompass the earth, according to Jim Allison. Upon one of these ley lines is built the five great Revolutionary War cities in early America, starting with there's Boston, New York, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and Washington, D.C., are all built in a straight line along the eastern seaboard. And we point this out, and we've got, you know, some animation that we show in the documentary with maps and charts and some commentary showing that these things are built in alignment. Not only are these five cities built in alignment one with another, but they're also built in perfect alignment with Stonehenge, which, of course, as we know, is in England, just near or in Salisbury, I believe. Anyway, so the question is that we present, is this evidence that America was being designed from its very beginnings by the Masons and the early builders who came over here? And we show that these guys came over at the behest of Sir Francis Bacon and his Masonic and Rosicrucian movement at the time, through guys like Sir Walter Raleigh. And
hold that thought. We'll be right there here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris was just saying that, of course, the followers of Sir Francis Bacon came to America after Bacon's death, but certainly they came at the behest of Sir Francis Bacon and Sir Walter Raleigh and others who were all part of these secret societies. So pick up the story there, Chris.
Well, Bacon definitely sent these societies here, and we've got William Schneblin, who does a great job, I think, in his interview in the documentary. He talks about what he calls the first occult beachhead in America, which is the Ephrata Cloister. And it's in Ephrata, Pennsylvania. And it was initially a Rosicrucian commune, a Rosicrucian community that came to America with, you know, a similar dream to the pilgrims. You know, the pilgrims came over to spread Christianity and, you know, live and establish a Christian nation. But the Rosicrucians came for the purpose of establishing this secret society nation that they hoped would grow and develop and so on. And I was even reading an article after we finished the documentary about, or maybe it was just as we were finishing it anyway, but that Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, Franklin, of course, who was both a Mason and a Rosicrucian, had visited the Ephrata Cloister at one point in their lifetime. And there's a lot of evidence that both Jefferson and Franklin were very much into the teachings of Sir Francis Bacon and greatly influenced by him. Jefferson, in particular, believed that Francis Bacon was one of the three most important men in history, and some believe, some claim that Jefferson viewed himself as fulfilling Bacon's dream for a new Atlantis by founding the United States of America. So, you know, Bacon had a very compelling influence on men like Thomas Jefferson, men like Benjamin Franklin, of course, who most likely followed Bacon's ideas on the printing press publishing literary works to influence people, which both of them did in their lifetimes. And Benjamin Franklin even published a book on ciphers and secret codes, which Bacon was a master of. And one of the things that you mentioned earlier, Dr. Stan, was how the intelligence community is embroiled or enmeshed with secret societies. And one of the things we talk about in this documentary is how the secret societies really founded the modern intelligence network, at least in the West, it would seem. And Bacon and his Rosicrucians were part of that. According to Peter Dawkins, who spent more than 30 years researching these guys, he says that the Rosicrucians formed in England for the purpose of protecting Queen Elizabeth I after she came to the throne, and the Vatican wanted her killed, of course, because she was a Protestant, so all of these assassins came out to try and kill her, and there were other Catholic empires and so on that were trying to overthrow her. And so the Rosicrucians formed this network around Queen Elizabeth. And a lot of these guys who were Rosicrucians, and they were a member of Bacon's Literary Society, were men like Ben Jonson, who was a poet, Christopher Marlowe, the famous playwright who wrote Dr. Faustus and so on, and there were a host of others. And these guys were writers, they were artists, and they were very much into the development of language, but they employed this initially in their intelligence work throughout Europe. And they were developing new words and so on so that they could communicate with each other in secrecy, and developing secret codes and whatnot that they were sending backwards and forwards. And of course, the English intelligence network under Francis Walsingham during this era is legendary, to this day. And we see the secret societies hand in glove with the intelligence network, which is, I believe, a tradition that has continued from that time to the present day, because then you find the same thing happening, and we talk about this with Benjamin Franklin during the Revolutionary War, that Franklin, who was a Freemason and a Rosicrucian, and he was a member of, he was a Grand Master of a lodge in Philadelphia, Grand Master of the French Lodge there in Paris, and he was a member of the Hellfire Club in England. And of course, America, England, and France were the three countries that were involved in the Revolutionary War. And there's evidence that Franklin had a communication system that was going, throughout these three countries, and people working behind the scenes in each of them, through the Masonic Lodge, through the Rosicrucian, most likely through the Rosicrucian Lodge, although I haven't found specific evidence to that effect, and most certainly through the Hellfire Club, for which there seems to be an abundance of evidence. And the Hellfire Club is something that a lot of people are unaware of, but they were a very clandestine, a very dark group of guys that came out of this whole movement of gentlemen's clubs in England and Scotland during the 16th and 17th century. And Franklin joined up with these guys through a man named Sir Francis Dashwood, who was the founder of the Hellfire Club at a place called in West Wickham. And he called the group the Monks of Medmenham Abbey. And there's a very interesting link with Dashwood and a modern Mason and Rosicrucian named Aleister Crowley, which you and I know have studied in other work. The Hellfire Club donned the motto. In fact, over the Hellfire Cave was the motto, "Do what thou wilt."
Of course, that was Crowley's slogan, wasn't it?
Right. But Crowley most likely picked it up from, we know he picked it up from Francois Rabelais, the French priest who coined the phrase in his book Pantagruel, his book Pantagruel, where he had this imaginary place that one of his characters built called the Abbey Thelema, and in the Abbey Thelema there was but one rule or law, and that was do what you will or do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. And the Hellfire Club picked up on this, and that was their motto. And it was really just to follow the desires of your own will. And of course, this was the Thelema was Crowley's religion that he founded, his new religion, and he even started his own Abbey Thelema after Francois Rabelais' imaginary Thelema in Sicily. And of course, that's where it's because of the bizarre occult rituals and so on that Crowley was into that he became known as the wickedest man in the world, according to the London newspapers in his time. But it's very likely, I think, that Crowley knew about Dashwood because they were both Englishmen. Crowley was very much like a modern Hellfire Club member. He was very wealthy. You know, he had a lot of money, and he was English, and he loved to party. He was very much into the occult, and he was a rough character. And the Hellfire members were really rough characters as well. But they were, at the same time, they were very serious guys. As we point out, Dashwood was, you know, involved in the House of Lords and the House of Commons for more than 20 years.
Now, of course, I think one of the interesting things is the tie-in to the intelligence community. Certainly we know that Aleister Crowley, who is known affectionately by the people who knew him when he lived on a house on Loch Ness, as the other Loch Ness monster, but he was deeply involved with intelligence, and so many of these people have been involved with the intelligence agencies. And one of the most fascinating things was the tie-in between a man named James Bond, who of course was created a fictional character, but Dr. D. Would you like to talk a little bit about that? I thought that was a fascinating thing. I'd never heard of that before, but obviously the man who created the gentleman who created James Bond had formerly worked for British intelligence, and he knew about Dr. D and 007.
Yeah, in fact, Ian Fleming, very, very quickly, Ian Fleming, during World War II, he was a part of British intelligence. He had actually come up with the idea to employ Aleister Crowley for intelligence work in dealing with the Nazis. But his idea for James Bond came from Dr. John Dee, because Dee was known in the intelligence network as 007. And he was a very close advisor to Queen Elizabeth I. He was the Queen's astrologer. He had cast the astrological chart for when Queen Elizabeth would be coronated as queen. And so he was very close in the court. He fared very well under Elizabeth, and he always signed his correspondence to the queen 007. And that's something we talk about in the documentary, and Ian Fleming picked up on that, and that it's from there that he developed the whole idea of James Bond, Agent 007, and so on.
And of course, Dee, who we're talking, he must have been living, what, in the 1500s, early 1600s?
In the same time as Sir Francis Bacon, in the late 1500s, early 1600s. I'm trying to remember exactly when Dee passed away, but I don't know the exact year. But he preceded Francis Bacon by about 30 years,
right?
But he definitely knew Bacon. He knew Bacon's family, and they were from the same era. There's at least one record of Bacon going to Dee's library at Mortlake, where Dee lived, and so on. And there's a lot of evidence that Bacon was influenced by him.
And of course, these people were all deeply involved in the occult. And when you understand that, so much of what's going on makes sense. There really are people who've gone over to the other side. And of course, there's great reward there. There's great financial advantage. You can see this in the musicians who've given themselves over to Lucifer. And you'll see them the sign there. With the index and small finger outstretched and the thumb out to the side. But of course, most people don't know that that is the sign of the devil. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Why don't you go ahead and pick up the story there, Chris?
Well, we're talking about Dr. John Dee and the influence. Just very quickly, not only was John Dee the inspiration for James Bond, but he was also the inspiration for Gandalf, the old wizard in Lord of the Rings. is also believed to be the influence for Albus Dumbledore, the magician the magician in the Harry Potter books, who's so famous, played by Richard Harris initially until he passed away. But he's been a very, very kind of secretly influential guy. You know, he developed, there are some who even believe that it was Dee who founded the modern Rosicrucian movement prior to Bacon. But he was, whether he founded it or not, the least that people say about him is that he was very, very much involved with it at its core level there in England. And at some point he became the leader of it, Dee did, and at some point he gave over the reins to Sir Francis Bacon. And we even show in the documentary there's like an old world engraving of a wizened looking old man in the dead of night handing over a lamp to a younger man in Elizabethan clothing. And Baconians believe that this is an image of Dr. John Dee passing the lamp of esoteric or occult wisdom and knowledge to Sir Francis Bacon. And this whole concept of passing the lamp, when I was doing research for the documentary, I actually went to PRS, the Philosophic Research Society, and saw a lot of Manly P. Hall's materials. And Hall, you know, has written more than 200 books. The guy gave some 8,000 lectures while he was still alive. And today at PRS, he's got all kinds of audio tapes and videotapes and things like that. But one of the concepts that's present in his teachings, and you can just read some of the titles of his work, is the whole concept of passing the lamp. And, of course, that lamp representing knowledge and light and, you know, Masonic enlightenment, which, of course, comes from the esoteric, the mysteries, the occult. And even in the Masonic Museum here in Los Angeles, down in Wilshire Boulevard, they have this statue of the lamp bearer, you know, who's standing there holding out the lamp. And so the lamp for Masons and Rosicrucians is very symbolic. And it's believed that John Dee passed that lamp to Sir Francis Bacon, which is very significant because when you study Dee, there's no question about it, was deeply involved in the occult, in channeling spirits and angels and demons and all this other kind of stuff, and that's where he was getting a lot of his information and knowledge and so on. He developed this whole system of magic that's called Enochian magic, that men like Aleister Crowley and others have been into. I mean, you can get books on it today. And it was supposedly given to John Dee by these angelic beings, these, you know, demonic powers that he was in communication with. And according to Bill Schneblin, who's, you know, a former occultist, it's a very, very powerful system and very intricate. It's got its own alphabet. All this stuff involved, it's pretty heavy stuff.
Oh, that's all right. We'll be sure. Back with Chris Pinto in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Chris Pinto. We're talking about, we're really talking about the a new DVD that he's just put out. It's only been out less than a week. It's called The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning, and of course, talking about these ideas of passing the lamp. And of course, unless you understand that from the very inception of America, there have been occultists here who wanted to use America's power, America's, of course, a military to bring about this new world order. And right now, we are moving rapidly towards a war in the Middle East. And there are many people who think it'll just be a weak war. We'll just bomb Iran, and that'll be the end of the war. Well, there were a lot of people who, at the First World War, thought, this is just going to be a little war between Serbia and Austria-Hungary. It'll be over in a week or two, and that's what they all thought. And 20 million dead people later, and another 40 million wounded people later, why the war came to an end. But they didn't have nuclear weapons at that time. And what we're really looking about towards is a nuclear war in the Middle East. Because if you think that the Iranians are going to sit back as we simply move in and bomb their nuclear production facilities, you don't have any idea. They do have nuclear weapons. Joseph Podansky has been writing about that for years. He's the in charge of research for the Republicans in the House of Representatives. The Pakistanis have nuclear weapons. And, of course, if we attack Iran, there will probably be a revolution in Pakistan. And the radical Islamic people, the followers of Osama bin Laden, will seize control of Pakistan with all of their nuclear weapons. We are on the brink, on the very edge of cataclysmic changes. Now, is this going to happen in a few months? We don't know. Maybe it'll wait, as one of my guests says, until after the November elections. But then, of course, he's looking at it logically. And nothing, of course, that's going on today is logical. Go ahead and pick up the story there, Chris.
Well, you know, since we're talking about modern developments, one of the things that we try to do in Secret Mysteries is to show that this plan, which is an ancient plan that goes back thousands of years for the New Atlantean Empire, is really most likely the driving force behind what's happening with the Bush administration, with the war in Iraq. And, you know, we ask the question, you know, as America marches forward to spread democracy throughout the globe, which is exactly what President Bush is doing, and it's what he's promoting, that his way of solving the war on terror is not just to go and, you know, wipe out the terrorists or whatever, but it's to bring democracy to all of these terrorist nations, and that's supposedly going to solve the problem. Well, that solution that he's presenting, which, as you said, is not really indicative of America. We were founded as a republic, not a democracy. Many of the founding fathers believed democracy in its true form was a horrible form of government. And so we were founded as a republic. But President Bush is going around the world to spread world democracy. And so we pose the question in Secret Mysteries, is it just a coincidence that the war in Iraq has provided this opportunity to really carry out the ancient hope, as President Bush has called it, of the secret societies? And that is, that ancient hope is spelled out very clearly by Manly P. Hall in his writings as this worldwide democratic commonwealth of nations. And that's exactly what the Bush administration is promoting and pursuing. And that's what the war in Iraq is all about. That's what the war on terror is all about. And it provides the obvious vehicle for democracy to be spread. And I guess because most Americans and most people in the world don't understand, you know, what a pure democracy would be. In a pure democracy, if 51% of the people want something, you give it to them. You know, if 51% of the people want to legalize rape, or, you know, child molestation or something, then that would become legalized in a true democracy. You wouldn't have any fixed laws. The laws would be subject to change based upon the whim of the people. And this was something that a number of the founding fathers spoke against. And it's not a form of government that, in my opinion, would really serve mankind ultimately.
And, of course, we've seen what happens when you have a democracy, a democratic vote in Palestine. They, of course, voted in Hamas, dedicated to war with Israel.
Yeah.
If they had a free election in Egypt, why radical Islam would take over there tomorrow. If they had a free election in Turkey, why radical Islam would take over. The only reason they haven't is because they have a military dictatorship with a facade of democracy. Ladies and gentlemen, we're moving into terribly dangerous times. And the average American has no idea that behind all of this is the ancient plan of the mystery religions and the secret society. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Chris Pinto. The DVD, which is available, is called The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning. Now, is this going to be available in video, or is it primarily going to be available in DVD?
You know what? The initial release is DVD because I guess both David and my experience just with our ministries and moving videos and things like that is that DVDs, dramatically outsell the VHS copies. But we are going to release it on VHS somewhere in the next couple of weeks. We're working on the VHS version even now. We just got to get it over there and get it to the duplicator. But we're going to do like a limited release on VHS. But mostly it's on DVD right now. It's available. I think Dr. Stan is carrying it at Radio Liberty. And but yeah, we're hoping to get the VHS copies out in a few weeks.
And I think it's really so a very, very effective tool. I might mention we do carry Mandy P. Hall's book. We have them on a very you have to ask for them specifically. We don't put them in the general catalog, but we have his Secret Destiny of America, his Secret Teachings of All Ages, his The Lost Keys of Freemasonry, and books like Wayne Peterson's book, Extraordinary Times, Extraordinary Beings, Mr. Peterson's In Contact with the Other Dimension. In fact, he and people from all over the world are moving to Henderson, Nevada, waiting for the return of the Lord, Maitreya. And that's why Henderson today is one of the most rapidly growing areas in the entire country. Why Henderson, Nevada? Why they're being drawn there by forces that they don't even understand. But there are these forces in the world. The book, Extraordinary Times, Extraordinary Beings. But all of this ties into what Chris is trying to bring out, and it brings out so vividly in this DVD, and that is that there really are secret societies. There really is a master plan that comes from a supernatural force. And so pick up the story there, Chris.
Yeah, the supernatural side of this story is really, I think you would agree, Dr. Stan, it's the through line through every leg of the journey. And we find those links there in the story of Francis Bacon and the early colonization movement to come to the New World and to launch it into this esoteric empire. And that was a dream that was really kind of formalized by Francis Bacon in his lifetime, set down in his New Atlantis, his Novum Organum, his development of the
science. Hold that right there.
Sure.
Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is Chris Pinto, and the DVD is entitled The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning. So go ahead, pick up the story there, Chris.
Well, the supernatural side of it, interestingly enough, we were talking about. But one of the things I wanted to say along these lines, Bacon's supernatural contact that we chronicle and we show it there in the documentary is through his muse, his inspiration, Pallas Athena. And Pallas Athena was the Greek goddess who wore a great helmet, and whoever donned the helmet would become invisible. The helmet of Athena granted invisibility, which is kind of a symbol for secrecy. So Bacon had this group that he called the Knights of the Helmet. And the Knights of the Helmet is a reference to the helmet of Athena. And one of the things that Athena was known for was carrying a great spear, and she shook her spear, supposedly, at the Dragon of Ignorance. And the spear represented light or knowledge. In Masonry, light is knowledge. And so Baconians believe, and there's a lot of evidence to it, that this whole idea of the spear shaker was something that Bacon turned and he flipped it around, and he used it as the name Shakespeare. And so there are many writers, many researchers, including guys like Peter Dawkins, certainly, and Manly P. Hall, who believe that Sir Francis Bacon is the real genius behind the Shakespeare plays. And the plays themselves were inspired initially, the impetus for them, came from the supernatural realm, from this vision that Bacon had, where this heavenly voice instructed him to hide his work secretly, to put aside popular applause, you know, not look for the roar of the crowd himself, but to do his work in secret. And Bacon even writes about this in his own writings, writes about, you know, doing his work in secret like Solomon the king, and it's a reference to the proverb that says it is the glory of God to conceal a thing, but the honor of kings is to search out a matter. And so Bacon writes about that proverb and how in the imitation of God, even as God conceals his work, Bacon would conceal his own work behind the identity of Shakespeare. And so then we spend a pretty good bit of time talking about the whole Bacon-Shakespeare controversy, because as Manly Hall says in his book, The Secret Teachings of All Ages, Bacon supposedly wrote into the Shakespeare plays the principles and teachings of Rosicrucianism and the true ceremonies, as Hall puts it, of the Freemasonic order. So he's incorporating the principles of the ancient mysteries and the secret societies into the writings of Shakespeare.
And, you know, I think if you go back and you study Shakespeare, and I'm not a great a scholar of this, but, I mean, this was magnificent poetry. I mean, it was magnificent stories. And, I mean, there were so many of them. I mean, they're one of the most prolific writers of all time. And the question is, you know, did William Shakespeare, who was barely literate, really do this? I mean, he could barely write his name, you know. And of course, you actually go to the home of the William Shakespeare there and talk to the man who heads that museum, who is very, very defensive of William Shakespeare. Tries to sort of say, well, of course he wrote, of course everybody knows he wrote it, but you almost had a feeling he was a little defensive, wasn't he?
Oh, he certainly was. He and Peter Dawkins both really, really nice men. They both were, and they're both on opposing sides of this debate. But we present both of their arguments, and I don't know, I became really persuaded after talking to him and really examining his interview. I really do believe that, that Bacon and his literary group were behind the plays. But some of his, defenses of the Stratford actor, as he's called, William Shakespeare, as some people refer to him, kind of reveal that there's more to the story. I mean, to me, the thing that, and we really unfolded in the documentary, and we let the guys who have studied this for years talk about the evidence, and we point out some of the secret clues that are there, so I don't want to give them all away.
Well, we don't want it because people will want to see the DVD, and even more than that, why, of course, when you get you know, well into it, you know, get towards the end, you want to see more. And of course, it ends at almost 3 hours, but you can hardly wait for the next part to come about. And of course, that's going to be what is it? The cast in stone, cut in stone.
Riddles in stone. We're gonna do a documentary on the secret architecture of Washington D.C. That's going to be volume 2.
And of course, Washington D.C. is laid out in Masonic form. It's covered in the book, The Secret Architecture of Our Nation's Capital, put up by HarperCollins. Everything in Washington D.C. is Masonic. Masonic symbols, astrological symbols. This is well known, except of course to the average American, who has no idea what this is really all about. That is, you know, as I considered what you were telling me about, you know, did Shakespeare write Shakespeare, or did St. Francis Bacon with his group write Shakespeare? And then, of course, I had the other alternative in my mind, and that was, was this all channeled as Sir Francis Bacon by a demonic spirit? And, of course, if you go into the backgrounds of the writings of Alice Bailey, and certainly Barbara Marx Hubbard, and Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, and even many of our great writers of modern times, Taylor Caldwell, so many of her great books, even books that had a strong Christian background, and yet she herself was not a Christian, and she never knew where the stories came from. She actually, there's a book written, In Search of Her Soul, or In Search of Her Meaning, written by a man who, as she went to seances to find out where she got the ideas for the wonderful stories she wrote. And I couldn't help but wonder, if perhaps much of this was channeled through Sir Francis Bacon, then, of course, to begin to mold and change British society. And Shakespeare has had such a profound impact on British and certainly on American society. Have you ever considered that maybe this was all channeled?
Well, it certainly would fit in with the model that's there. I mean, it's from channeling a spirit that Bacon was inspired to write theatrical works, and he was writing them with his literary group, many of whom were members of the Rosicrucian society. And the Rosicrucians believed in tapping into the spirit realm to gain knowledge and understanding and wisdom and so on. So I think what you're saying, Dr. Stan, is not only very likely, I think that's, you know, that's exactly how it came about. I think that has to do with the great brilliance of the plays and the writings themselves, that there's, you know, there's a tremendous amount of knowledge in the plays, a lot of information, and just brilliance about the human condition. And interwoven, as we pointed out, it really represents Rosicrucianism as a whole, because it incorporates the teachings of Christianity with the teachings of paganism and the esoteric mysteries, and they're all intertwined together. You know, you've got Romeo and Juliet and Hamlet right alongside Midsummer Night's Dream and Macbeth, and you've got all of these occult elements that are interwoven in the plays, and with them are certain biblical principles. And this can be very confusing, I think, to those who study the plays. There's even a book written by Dr. I.D.E. Thomas called Man of the Millennium, William Shakespeare and His Bible. And he's of course writing from the perspective that Shakespeare was probably a Bible-believing Christian man. And it can seem that way if you just focus on the biblical verses in the plays. But to do that, you know, you're going to ignore now all of the esoteric and occult elements and philosophies and so on that are interwoven with those teachings. And that's really a picture to me of what America has become. It has become this intertwining. So you've got our president, who many people believe is a fundamental Bible-believing evangelical Christian man, and yet he's going to mosques and he's saying that Allah is the same as the God of the Bible. He's recorded worshiping at a Shinto Buddhist shrine, you know, and he's saying things like there are many paths to God and so on, all the while that he's claiming to be a devout Christian.
And of course, he is leading the world into a nuclear holocaust, and whether he knows it or not, this is the direction we're headed today, as plans are already been taken for the bombing of Iran. And, of course, Syria will be right along with that. And then, like an incendiary device, the whole of the Islamic world will light up. Well, let's go to Ted, who's calling us from Georgia. I'd appreciate if other people did not call in, but as long as Ted is here. Ted, did you have a question for our guest?
Well, yes, I have a question. Is the Federalist Movement, the Federalist Society, included in the book?
No, this is not. Has nothing to do with the Federalist Society.
Why doesn't it? I don't understand. The Federalist Society is very much part of the English movement in reaction to the Revolutionary War.
Do you have any comment on that, Chris?
You know what, I've heard of the Federalist Society. I'm not entirely certain when they came about, but I honestly did not stumble across them when I was researching Francis Bacon. Is there a direct correlation to Bacon?
I don't know that there's a direct correlation to Bacon, except that the English is part of the English movement, in my opinion.
All right, fine. Well, of course, this is really about the secret society that Francis Bacon created about the same time that why the first settlers were coming to America. But thanks so much, Ted. And let's get back, of course, to this whole idea of the esoteric organizations, because certainly you can look at the Templars and the Rosicrucians, and if you go into the background of Masonry and you see the various degrees they take, there's one that is the Knights Templar. Another one, of course, is the Rosicrucian. So embedded within modern-day Masonry, at least the Scottish Rite branch, are these other ancient secret societies. And this ties into Gnosticism, it ties into the Kabbalah, it ties into so many different esoteric organizations and movements that have been around down through the ages. Would you agree with that?
Oh, certainly. I mean, this whole thing is, it really does go back, you know, as far back as man's history goes. It goes back to you could trace it all the way back to the Garden of Eden, the temptation of the serpent to man with the tree of knowledge is entirely what Bacon represents, because it was through knowledge or science that Bacon believed mankind could achieve his own salvation. And Peter Dawkins, who's the real Baconian expert, and he writes books on this stuff, he talks about the Rosicrucian and Freemasonic 6 days work, which, you know, Bacon believed in the 6 days work of creation, that, you know, just like God created the earth, the heavens and the earth and all that is in them in 6 days, he believed that it was man's responsibility since his fall in the Garden of Eden to recreate paradise on earth, okay? And he would do it through knowledge and experience and by building his own paradise on earth. And then man would really be in a perfect state because he would have earned his paradise by his own hard labor. Okay? And of course, if you're a Christian and you believe the teachings of the Bible and you believe that we're not saved by our works, but by God's grace through faith in Jesus Christ, this movement, as good as it sounds to the human condition, it doesn't seem from what I've studied of Bacon that he had some sort of sinister motivation. He seemed to have had a very, you know, humanistic and, you know, true desire to help humanity. But it's his method of helping humanity is the antithesis of the gospel message. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh, I think it certainly does. And, of course, with so many religions, it's how we are going to bring the kingdom of heaven to earth. And, of course, the radical Muslim believes that if they can create a world chaos, they're going to be able to bring the Mahdi back. And the Jew waits for the Messiah. And, of course, the Hindu waits for the return of the Maitreya. The Christian waits for the coming, second coming of Jesus Christ. But the question is, there's certainly all the others are waiting, I believe, for the man of sin that's described in Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians. And there is to come a world ruler, a demonic ruler, I believe, part of the unholy Trinity. It just as there's a Trinity of Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, so there is the Antichrist, there is the false prophet, and there is Satan himself in the unholy Trinity. And I really think that we are seeing unfolding before us truly prophetic things that are going to happen that will change the world we live in forever.
Yeah, well, it's certainly, Bacon, I think, in this New Atlantean concept, I believe really fits into Bible prophecy. In fact, one of the titles that Bacon gave himself was the Herald of the New Age. And as Peter Dawkins says in the documentary, you know, that he was, that the Herald of the New Age, that's the title given to Elijah, who comes to herald the coming of the Christ. So Bacon is seen by Baconians as this kind of herald for the coming Christ figure. And we asked the question in the documentary, rather carefully, is this the Christ of the Bible, or is this the Christ of Masonry, some other Christ? And we know as Christians that the Greek prefix anti has two meanings. It means against, but it also means another. So another Christ is literally Antichrist. And if you study the New Age movement, that's very much what it seems at this time that the Antichrist figure will be, another Messiah. He won't necessarily look like a Saddam Hussein character, you know, with a shotgun off the balcony or something. He will probably be a very appealing, enlightened person. who people will gravitate toward. The Bible says that all the world will worship him, whose names are not found written in the Lamb's Book of Life. So it would certainly seem that Bacon's idea for creating the perfect society, and Bacon's idea of what the Christ figure might be, would certainly fit into that.
And of course, the thing is, people are not going to want to give up their sovereignty, their freedom, until some terribly cataclysmic event happens. Could we be facing just such an event at these times? What a wonderful time it is to have a personal relationship with our Lord. Well, we'll be back here in just a minute with Chris Pinto to wrap up this evening's program. Remember the name of the video or the DVD? It's called The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning. The Secret Mystery of America's Beginning of the New Atlantis, Part 1. Well, Chris, the 2 hours certainly has flown by. You've got 3 minutes to wrap up tonight's program.
Wow. Well, I really hope people will take an interest in Secret Mysteries. What we tried to do with this documentary was to present some evidence concerning this one-world movement that's promoting a world government and a world religion and so on, ultimately to be headed up by a world leader, and to talk about it from a perspective that at least I haven't seen much talked about in the in the documentary realm in our community, Dr. Stan. It's something that you find deeply buried within a lot of the esoteric writings. You'll find it definitely very prominently by Manly P. Hall. There are mentions of it by Albert Pike. He talks about the Atlantean mystery schools and so on, and in Masonic writings and a lot of the esoteric writings. You know, they refer to ancient Atlantis. They refer to Lemuria, which is, you know, another ancient society that supposedly existed. And I think it's so important to understand the concept, because the New Atlantis concept is especially deceptive, because it is really not engineered as an outwardly sinister program. It's a program that seems very appealing. Build paradise on earth, help people, do charitable works, do a good thing for humanity, lead humanity into self-empowerment and creating their own godlike reality upon the earth. And that sounds like a good thing if you don't know the gospel. And I think that's what most people are going to be drawn to. I think it's why the Bible says that all the world is going to worship this world leader. They're not going to be worshiping a Saddam Hussein character. It'll be a guy who they believe is a truly enlightened and wonderful person. And of course, we know that at some point this will all take a very dark turn. And exactly how it's all going to play out, the Lord knows. I don't pretend to know too much. We just try to provide as many pieces of the puzzle as we can set down.
Well, you certainly have done a great job of connecting the dots, and I think that anybody who sees this video will be actually transfixed by it. Tremendous a musical presentation, tremendous emotional impact, but of course all soundly based upon the history of the past, which explains the present. God bless you. Thank you so much, Chris, and we'll look forward to talking again real soon.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. God bless you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I hope that you enjoyed our conversation with Chris this evening. It's been sort of a marathon, but I think the information is so vitally important. And, of course, if you'd like to know more about the video, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, The Secret Mysteries, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. You can call 1-800-544-8927. If you're interested in the esoteric writings of Manly P. Hall, why, you can call the same number. We have a special catalog with listed his books, The Secret Destiny of America, The Secret Teachings of All Ages, The Lost Keys of Freemasonry, and then the several other books there. We have his ancient teachings of ancient lectures on the secrets of ancient lectures, and then of course the book the Extraordinary Times, Extraordinary Beings. They're all in our esoteric section. We say this is only for researchers, understanding that you're dealing with very dark forces, but they're not imaginary, they're real, and they're influencing, knowingly or unknowingly, many of the things that are going on today. If you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, let me stress, I believe it's very, very important. And then, of course, our pamphlets on the occult hierarchy. Because there is an occult hierarchy that rules the world today. Go to the Google and simply Google in the occult hierarchy, and there are articles there by people who are part of the movement. It's not imaginary, it's real. And then, of course, we hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and helping us as we reach out 5 hours every day. Weekday, and of course on the weekends with a half-hour program, trying to educate the American people as to what's really going on in our society today. Again, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage is radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. And we encourage you to go there and to pull down our newsletters. You can listen to our archives without charge, and we have them in both archived and MP3 format. You can, of course, listen to them live during the course of the day, but you can also listen to them in the evening. And, of course, we hope that you'll tell others about our program and try to introduce them into this concept that there are two parallel forces in America. There have always been two parallel forces in the world, starting at the Garden of Eden, but especially when America was founded. There were those who wanted a Christian nation, and those who wanted an occult nation, and of course, to eventually use America's military power and financial power to bring about the New World Order, the association of enlightened democratic societies. And this plan's been around for a long time. And if you read the writings of George Bush, it's almost as if you're reading the writings of Manly P. Hall. And they're all talking about bringing about world democracy. Why do we want to bring world democracy when America isn't a democracy? You can read the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, the Federalist Papers, the constitutions of all of our states, the Bill of Rights, and never see the word democracy other than decry it and say we're a republic. Why? Because American foreign policy is to bring enlightened democracies to the world. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, until we're together again. May the Lord be with you.